We do not have much else, but everybody knows tinkers will steal anything.
Including infants? Elias asked dryly. Kidnap children and all that? He spat, and she blushed. Those stories about babies were told sometimes, but most often by Sen Bui or one of the Coplins or Congers. The other tales everybody knew. The tinkers make me sick sometimes, but they don't steal any more than most folks. A good bit less than some, I know.
It will be getting dark soon, Elias, Perrin said. We have to camp somewhere. Why not with them, if they'll have us?
Mistress Luhan had a tinker-mended pot that she claimed was better than new. Master Luhan was not too happy about his wife's praise of the tinker work, but Perrin wanted to see how it was done. Yet there was a reluctance about Elias that he did not understand.
Is there some reason we shouldn't?
Elias shook his head, but the reluctance was still there in the set of his shoulders and the tightness of his mouth.
May as well. Just don't pay any mind to what they say. A lot of foolishness. Most times the traveling people do things any which way. But there's times they set a store by formality. So you do what I do. And keep your secrets. No need to tell the world everything.
The dogs trailed along beside them, wagging their tails as Elias led the way into the trees. Perrin felt the wolves slow and knew they would not enter. They were not afraid of the dogs. They were contemptuous of dogs, who had given up freedom to sleep by a fire. But people they avoided. Elias walked surely, as if he knew the way, and near the center of the stand the tinker's wagons appeared, scattered among the oak and ash. Like everyone else in Emmonsfield, Perrin had heard a good deal about the tinkers, even if he had never seen any, and the camp was just what he expected. Their wagons were small houses on wheels, tall wooden boxes lacquered and painted in bright colors, reds and blues and yellows and greens, and some hues to which he could not put a name. The traveling people were going about work that was disappointingly every day, cooking, sewing, tending children, mending harness, but their clothes were even more colorful than the wagons, and seemingly chosen at random. Sometimes coat and breeches, or dress and shawl, went together in a way that hurt the eyes. They looked like butterflies in a field of wild flowers. Four or five men in different places around the camp played fiddles and flutes, and a few people danced like rainbow-hued hummingbirds. Children and dogs ran playing among the cook fires. The dogs were mastiffs, just like those that had confronted the travelers, but the children tugged at their ears and tails and climbed on their backs, and the massive dogs accepted it all placidly. The three with Elias, tongues hanging out, looked up at the bearded man as if he were their best friend. Perrin shook his head. They were still big enough to reach a man's throat while barely getting their front feet off the ground. Abruptly, the music stopped, and he realized all the tinkers were looking at him and his companions. Even the children and dogs stood still and watched, warily, as if on the point of flight. For a moment there was no sound at all. Then a wiry man, gray-haired and short, stepped forward and bowed gravely to Elias. He wore a high-collared red coat and baggy bright green trousers tucked into knee boots.
"You are welcome to our fires. Do you know the song?"
Elias bowed in the same way, both hands pressed to his chest.
"Your welcome warms my spirit, Mahdi, as your fires warm the flesh. But I do not know the song."
"Then we seek still," the gray-haired man intoned. "As it was, so shall it be, if we but remember, seek, and find."
He swept an arm toward the fires with a smile, and his voice took on a cheerful lightness.
"The meal is almost ready. Join us, please."
As if that had been a signal, the music sprang up again, and the children took up their laughter and ran with the dogs. Everyone in the camp went back to what they had been doing, just as though the newcomers were long-accepted friends. The gray-haired man hesitated, though, and looked at Elias.
"Your other friends? They will stay away? They frightened the poor dog so."
"They'll stay away, Rain,"
Elias's headshake had a touch of scorn. "You should know that by now."
The gray-haired man spread his hands as if to say nothing was ever certain. As he turned to lead them into the camp, Egwene dismounted and moved close to Elias.
"You two are friends?"
A smiling tinker appeared to take Bella. Egwene gave the reins up reluctantly after a wry snort from Elias.
"We know each other," the fur-clad man replied curtly.
"His name is Mahdi," Perrin said.
Elias growled something under his breath.
"His name's Rain. Mahdi's his title. Seeker. He's the leader of this band. You can call him Seeker if the other sounds odd. He won't mind."
"What was that about a song?" Egwene asked.
"That's why they travel," Elias said, "or so they say. They're looking for a song. That's what the Mahdi seeks. They say they lost it during the breaking of the world, and if they can find it again, the paradise of the Age of Legends will return." He ran his eye around the camp and snorted. "They don't even know what the song is. They claim they'll know it when they find it. They don't know how it's supposed to bring paradise either, but they've been looking near to 3,000 years ever since the breaking. I expect they'll be looking until the wheel stops turning." They reached Rain's fire, then, in the middle of the camp. The Seeker's wagon was yellow, trimmed in red, and the spokes of its tall, red-rimmed wheels alternated red and yellow. A plump woman, as gray as Rain, but smooth-cheeked still, came out of the wagon and paused on the steps at its back end, straightening a blue-fringed shawl on her shoulders. Her blouse was yellow and her skirt red, both bright. The combination made Perrin blink, and Egwene made a strangled sound. When she saw the people following Rain, the woman came down with a welcoming smile. She was Ila, Rain's wife, a head taller than her husband, and she soon made Perrin forget about the colors of her clothes. She had a motherliness that reminded him of Mistress Alvear and had him feeling welcome from her first smile. Ila greeted Elias as an old acquaintance, but with a distance that seemed to pain Rain. Elias gave her a dry grin and a nod. Perrin and Egwene introduced themselves, and she clasped their hands in both of hers with much more warmth than she had shown Elias, even hugging Egwene.
"Why, you're lovely, child," she said, cupping Egwene's chin and smiling. "And chilled to the bone, too, I expect. You sit close to the fire, Egwene. All of you sit. Supper is almost ready."
Fallen logs had been pulled around the fire for sitting. Elias refused even that concession to civilization. He lounged on the ground instead. Iron tripods held two small kettles over the flames, and an oven rested in the edge of the coals. Ila tended them. As Perrin and the others were taking their places, a slender young man wearing green stripes strolled up to the fire. He gave Rain a hug and Ila a kiss, and ran a cool eye over Elias and the Emmonsfielders. He was about the same age as Perrin, and he moved as if he were about to begin dancing with his next step.
"Well, Aram," Ila smiled fondly, "you have decided to eat with your old grandparents for a change, have you?"
Her smile slid over to Egwene as she bent to stir a kettle hanging over the cook fire.
"I wonder why."
Aram settled to an easy crouch, with his arms crossed on his knees across the fire from Egwene.
"I am Aram," he told her in a low, confident voice.
He no longer seemed aware that anyone was there except her.
"I have waited for the first rose of spring, and now I find it at my grandfather's fire."
Perrin waited for Egwene to snicker, then saw that she was staring back at Aram. He looked at the young tinker again. Aram had more than his share of good looks, he admitted. After a minute, Perrin knew who the fellow reminded him of.
Will Alcine, who had all the girls staring and whispering behind his back whenever he came up from Devon Ride to Emmons Field.
Will courted every girl in sight and managed to convince every one of them that he was just being polite to all the others.
"Those dogs of yours," Perrin said loudly, and Egwene gave a start, "look as big as bears. I'm surprised you let the children play with them."
Aram's smile slipped, but when he looked at Perrin it came back again, even more sure than before.
"They will not harm you. They make a show to frighten away danger and warn us, but they are trained according to the Way of the Leaf."
"The Way of the Leaf?" Egwene said. "What is that?"
Aram gestured to the trees, his eyes fastened intently on hers.
"The leaf sits its appointed time and does not struggle against the wind that carries it away. The leaf does no harm, and finally falls to nourish new leaves. So it should be with all men and women."
Egwene stared back at him, a faint blush rising in her cheeks.
"But what does that mean?" Perrin said.
Aram gave him an irritated glance, but it was Rain who answered.
"It means that no man should harm another for any reason whatsoever."
The Seeker's eyes flickered to Elias.
"There is no excuse for violence. None. Not ever."
"What if somebody attacks you?" Perrin insisted. "What if somebody hits you or tries to rob you or kill you?"
Rain sighed, a patient sigh, as if Perrin was just not seeing what was so clear to him.
"If a man hit me, I would ask him why he wanted to do such a thing. If he still wanted to hit me, I would run away, as I would if he wanted to rob or kill me. Much better that I let him take what he wanted, even my life, than that I should do violence. And I would hope that he was not harmed too greatly."
"But you said you wouldn't hurt him," Perrin said.
"I would not. But violence harms the one who does it as much as the one who receives it."
Perrin looked doubtful.
"You could cut down a tree with your axe," Rain said. "The axe does violence to the tree and escapes unharmed."
"Is that how you see it?
Wood is soft compared to steel. But the sharp steel is dulled as it chops, and the sap of the tree will rust and pit it. The mighty axe does violence to the helpless tree and is harmed by it. So it is with men, though the harm is in the spirit."
"But—" "Enough," Elias growled, cutting Perrin off. "Rain, it's bad enough you trying to convert village younglings to that nonsense. It gets you in trouble almost everywhere you go, doesn't it? But I didn't bring this lot here for you to work on them. Leave over."
"And leave them to you,"
Ela said, grinding herbs between her palms and letting them trickle into one of the kettles. Her voice was calm, but her hands rubbed the herbs furiously.
"Will you teach them your way, to kill or die? Will you lead them to the fate you seek for yourself, dying alone with only the ravens and your friends to squabble over your body?"
"Be at peace, Ela," Rain said gently, as if he had heard this all and more 100 times.
"He has been welcomed to our fire, my wife."
Ela subsided, but Perrin noticed that she made no apology. Instead, she looked at Elias and shook her head sadly, then dusted her hands and began taking spoons and pottery bowls from a red chest on the side of the wagon. Rain turned back to Elias.
"My old friend, how many times must I tell you that we do not try to convert anyone? When village people are curious about our ways, we answer their questions. It is most often the young who ask, true, and sometimes one of them will come with us when we journey on. But it is of their own free will."
"You try telling that to some farm wife who's just found out her son or daughter has run off with you tinkers," Elias said wryly. "That's why the bigger towns won't even let you camp nearby. Villages put up with you for your mending things, but the cities don't need it, and they don't like you talking their young folks into running off."
"I would not know what the cities allow."
Rain's patience seemed inexhaustible. He certainly did not appear to be getting angry at all.
"There are always violent men in cities. In any case, I do not think the song could be found in a city."
"I don't mean to offend you, Seeker," Perrin said slowly, "but, well, I don't look for violence. I don't think I've even wrestled anybody in years except for feast day games. But if somebody hit me, I'd hit him back. If I didn't,
I would just be encouraging him to think he could hit me whenever he wanted to. Some people think they can take advantage of others, and if you don't let them know they can't, they'll just go around bullying anybody weaker than they are.
Some people, Aram said with a heavy sadness, can never overcome their baser instincts.
He said it with a look at Perrin that made it clear he was not talking about the bullies Perrin spoke of.
I'll bet you get to run away a lot, Perrin said.
And the young tinker's face tightened in a way that had nothing to do with the way of the leaf.
I think it is interesting, Egwene said, glaring at Perrin, to meet someone who doesn't believe his muscles can solve every problem.
Aram's good spirits returned, and he stood, offering her his hands with a smile.
Let me show you our camp. There is dancing. I would like that.
She smiled back. Ila straightened from taking loaves of bread from the small iron oven.
But supper is ready, Aram. I'll eat with mother,
Aram said over his shoulder, as he drew Egwene away from the wagon by her hand.
We will both eat with mother.
He flashed a triumphant smile at Perrin. Egwene was laughing as they ran. Perrin got to his feet, then stopped. It was not as if she could come to any harm, not if the camp followed this way of the leaf, as Rain said. Looking at Rain and Ila, both staring dejectedly after their grandson, he said,
I'm sorry. I am a guest, and I shouldn't have... Don't be foolish, Ila said soothingly. It was his fault, not yours. Sit down and eat.
Aram is a troubled young man, Rain added sadly. He is a good boy, but sometimes I think he finds the way of the leaf a hard way. Some do, I fear. Please, my fire is yours. Please?
Perrin sat back down slowly, still feeling awkward.
What happens to somebody who can't follow the way? He asked.
A tinker, I mean.
Rain and Ila exchanged a worried look, and Rain said,
They leave us. The lost go to live in the villages.
Ila stared in the direction her grandson had gone.
The lost cannot be happy.
She sighed, but her face was placid again when she handed out the bowls and spoons. Perrin stared at the ground, wishing he had not asked, and there was no more talk while Ila filled their bowls with the thick vegetable stew and handed out thick slices of her crusty bread. Nor while they ate. The stew was delicious, and Perrin finished three bowls before he stopped. Elias, he noted with a grin, emptied four. After the meal, Rain filled his pipe, and Elias produced his own and stuffed it from Rain's oilskin pouch. When the lighting and tamping and relighting were done, they settled back in silence. Ila took out a bundle of knitting. The sun was only a blaze of red above the treetops to the west. The camp had settled in for the night, but the bustle did not slow, only changed. The musicians who had been playing when they entered the camp had been replaced by others, and even more people than before danced in the light of the fires, their shadows leaping against the wagons. Somewhere in the camp, a chorus of male voices rose. Perrin slid down in front of the log and soon felt himself dozing.
After a time, Rain said, Have you visited any of the Tuatha'an, Elias, since you were with us last spring?
Perrin's eyes drifted open and half shut again.
No, Elias replied around his pipe stem. I don't like being around too many people at once.
Rain chuckled.
Especially people who live in a way so opposite to your own, eh? No, my old friend, don't worry. I gave up years ago hoping you would come to the way. But I have heard a story since last we met, and if you have not heard it yet, it might interest you. It interests me, and I have heard it again and again, every time we meet others of the people.
I'll listen.
It begins in the spring 2 years ago, with a band of the people who were crossing the waste by the northern route.
Perrin's eyes shot open.
The waste? The Aiel waste? They were crossing the Aiel waste?
Some people can enter the waste without being bothered, Elias said. Gleeman... Peddlers, if they're honest. The Tuatha'an cross the waste all the time. Merchants from Kyrian used to, before the tree and the Aiel War.
"The Aielmen avoid us," Rain said sadly, "though many of us have tried to speak with them. They watch us from a distance, but they will not come near us nor let us come near them. Sometimes I worry that they might know the song, though I suppose it isn't likely. Among Aiel, men do not sing, you know. Isn't that strange? From the time an Aiel boy becomes a man, he will not sing anything but battle chants or their dirge for the slain. I have heard them singing over their dead and over those they have killed. That song is one to make the stones weep."
Ila, listening, nodded agreement over her knitting. Perrin did some quick rethinking. He had thought the Tinkers must be afraid all the time, with all this talk of running away. But no one who was afraid would even think of crossing the Aiel Waste. From what he had heard, no one who was sane would try crossing the Waste.
"If this is some story about a song," Elias began, but Rain shook his head.
"No, my old friend, not a song. I am not sure I know what it is about."
He turned his attention to Perrin.
"Young Aiel often travel into the Blight. Some of the young men go alone, thinking for some reason that they have been called to kill the Dark One. Most go in small groups, to hunt Trollocs."
Rain shook his head sadly, and when he went on his voice was heavy.
"2 years ago, a band of the people crossing the Waste about 100 miles south of the Blight found one of these groups." "Young women," Ila put in, as sorrowful as her husband. "Little more than girls."
Perrin made a surprised sound, and Elias grinned at him wryly.
"You girls don't have to tend house and cook if they don't want to, boy. The ones who want to be warriors instead join one of the warrior societies. Far Darai's Mai, the Maidens of the Spear, and fight right alongside the men."
Perrin shook his head. Elias chuckled at his expression. Rain took up the story again, distaste and perplexity mingled in his voice.
"The young women were all dead, except one, and she was dying. She crawled to the wagons. It was clear she knew they were to Othaan. Her loathing outweighed her pain, but she had a message so important to her that she must pass it on to someone, even us, before she died. Men went to see if they could help any of the others. There was a trail of her blood to follow, but all were dead, and so were 3 times their number in Trollocs."
Elias sat up, his pipe almost falling from between his teeth.
100 miles into the Waste? Impossible! Javik Kashar!
That's what Trollocs call the Waste.
The Dying Ground. They wouldn't go 100 miles into the Waste if all the Murdrol and the Blight were driving them.
"You know an awful lot about Trollocs, Elias," Perrin said.
"Go on with your story," Elias told Rain gruffly.
"From trophies the Aiel carried, it was obvious they were coming back from the Blight. The Trollocs had followed, but by the tracks only a few lived to return after killing the Aiel. As for the girl, she would not let anyone touch her, even to tend her wounds. But she seized the seeker of that band by his coat. And this is what she said, word for word. Leaf Blighter means to blind the eye of the world, lost one. He means to slay the great serpent. Warn the people, lost one. Sightburner comes. Tell them to stand ready for he who comes with the dawn. Tell them." And then she died. "Leaf Blighter and Sight Burner," Rain added to Perrin, "are Aiel names for the Dark One. But I don't understand another word of it. Yet she thought it important enough to approach those she obviously despised, to pass it on with her last breath. But to who? We are ourselves the people, but I hardly think she meant it for us. The Aiel? They would not let us tell them if we tried."
He sighed heavily.
"She called us the Lost. I never knew before how much they loathe us."
Ila set her knitting in her lap and touched his head gently.
"Something they learned in the Blight," Elias mused, "but none of it makes sense.
slay the great serpent, kill time itself, and blind the eye of the world? As well say he's going to starve a rock. Maybe she was babbling, Rain. Wounded, dying, she could have lost her grip on what was real. Maybe she didn't even know who those Tuatha'an were.
She knew what she was saying, and to whom she was saying it. Something more important to her than her own life, and we cannot even understand it. When I saw you walking into our camp, I thought perhaps we would find the answer at last, since you were.
Elias made a quick motion with his hand, and Rain changed what he had been going to say.
Are a friend, and know many strange things.
Not about this, Elias said in a tone that put an end to talk. The silence around the campfire was broken only by the music and laughter drifting from other parts of the night-shrouded camp. Lying with his shoulders propped on one of the logs around the fire, Perrin tried puzzling out the Aiel woman's message, but it made no more sense to him than it had to Rain or Elias. The eye of the world. That had been in his dreams more than once, but he did not want to think about those dreams. Elias now. There was a question there he would like answered. What had Rain been about to say about the bearded man, and why had Elias cut him off? He had no luck with that either. He was trying to imagine what Aiel girls were like, going into the Blight where only warders went that he had ever heard, fighting Trollocs. When he heard Egwene coming back, singing to herself. Scrambling to his feet, he went to meet her at the edge of the firelight. She stopped short, looking at him with her head tilted to one side. In the dark, he could not read her expression.
"You've been gone a long time," he said. "Did you have fun?" "We ate with his mother," she answered, "and then we danced and laughed. It seems like forever since I danced."
"He reminds me of Will Alcine. You always had sense enough not to let Will put you in his pocket."
"Aram is a gentle boy who is fun to be with," she said in a tight voice. "He makes me laugh."
Perrin sighed.
"I'm sorry. I'm glad you had fun dancing."
Abruptly, she flung her arms around him, weeping on his shirt. Awkwardly, he patted her hair.
Rand would know what to do, he thought.
Rand had an easy way with girls. Not like him, who never knew what to do or say.
"I told you I'm sorry, Egwene. I really am glad you had fun dancing. Really." "Tell me they're alive," she mumbled into his chest.
"What?" She pushed back to arm's length, her hands on his arms, and looked up at him in the darkness.
"Rand and Matt, the others, tell me they are alive."
He took a deep breath and looked around uncertainly.
"They are alive," he said finally. "Good."
She scrubbed at her cheeks with quick fingers.
"That is what I wanted to hear. Good night, Perrin. Sleep well."
Standing on tiptoe, she brushed a kiss across his cheek and hurried past him before he could speak. He turned to watch her. Ela rose to meet her, and the two women went into the wagon talking quietly.
"Rand might understand it," he thought, "but I don't."
In the distant night, the wolves howled the first thin sliver of the new moon toward the horizon, and he shivered. Tomorrow would be time enough to worry about the wolves again. He was wrong. They were waiting to greet him in his dreams. Chapter 26. Whitebridge. The last unsteady note of what had been barely recognizable as the wind that shakes the willow faded mercifully away, and Matt lowered Tom's gold and silver-chased flute. Rand took his hands from his ears. A sailor coiling a line on the deck nearby heaved a loud sigh of relief. For a moment, the only sounds were the water slapping against the hull, the rhythmic creak of the oars, and now and again the hum of rigging strummed by the wind. The wind blew dead on to the spray's bow, and the useless sails were furled.
"I suppose I should thank you," Tom Marilyn muttered finally, "for teaching me how true the old saying is. Teach him how you will, a pig will never play the flute."
The sailor burst out laughing, and Matt raised the flute as if to throw it at him. Deftly, Tom snagged the instrument from Matt's fist and fitted it into its hard leather case.
I thought all you shepherds whiled away the time with the flock playing the pipes or the flute. That will show me to trust what I don't know firsthand.
Rand's the shepherd, Matt grumbled. He plays the pipes, not me.
Yes, well, he does have a little aptitude. Perhaps we had better work on juggling, boy. At least you show some talent for that.
Tom, Rand said, I don't know why you're trying so hard. He glanced at the sailor and lowered his voice. After all, we aren't really trying to become Gleeman. It's only something to hide behind until we find Moraine and the others. Tom tugged at an end of his mustache and seemed to be studying the smooth, dark brown leather of the flute case on his knees.
What if you don't find them, boy? There's nothing to say they're even still alive.
They're alive, Rand said firmly. He turned to Matt for support, but Matt's eyebrows were pinched down on his nose, and his mouth was a thin line, and his eyes were fixed on the deck. Well, speak up, Rand told him. You can't be that mad over not being able to play the flute. I can't either, not very well. You never wanted to play the flute before. Matt looked up, still frowning. What if they are dead? He said softly. We have to accept facts, right? At that moment, the lookout in the bow sang out,
White Bridge! White Bridge ahead!
For a long minute, unwilling to believe that Matt could say something like that so casually, Rand held his friend's gaze amid the scrabble of sailors preparing to put in. Matt glowered at him with his head pulled down between his shoulders. There was so much Rand wanted to say, but he could not manage to get it all into words. They had to believe the others were alive. They had to.
Why?
Nagged a voice in the back of his head.
So it will all turn out like one of Tom's stories? The heroes find the treasure and defeat the villain and live happily ever after? Some of his stories don't end that way. Sometimes even heroes die. Are you a hero, Randall Thor? Are you a hero, sheep herder?
Abruptly, Matt flushed and pulled his eyes away. Freed from his thoughts, Rand jumped up to move through the hurly-burly to the rail. Matt came after him slowly, not even making an effort to dodge the sailors who ran across his path. Men dashed about the boat, bare feet thumping the deck, hauling on ropes, tying off some lines, and untying others. Some brought up big oilskin bags stuffed almost to bursting with wool, while others readied the cables as thick as Rand's wrist. Despite their haste, they moved with the assurance of men who had done it all 1,000 times before. But Captain Doman stumped up and down the deck shouting orders and cursing those who did not move fast enough to suit him. Rand's attention was all for what lay ahead, coming plainly into sight as they rounded a slight bend of the Arenal. He had heard of it in song and story and peddler's tales, but now he would actually see the legend. The white bridge arched high over the wide waters, twice as high as the spray's mast and more. And from end to end, it gleamed milky white in the sunlight, gathering the light until it seemed to glow. Spidery piers of the same stuff plunged into the strong currents, appearing too frail to support the weight and width of the bridge. It looked all of one piece, as if it had been carved from a single stone or molded by a giant's hand, broad and tall, leaping the river with an airy grace that almost made the eye forget its size. All in all, it dwarfed the town that sprawled about its foot on the east bank, though Whitebridge was larger by far than Emmons Field, with houses of stone and brick as tall as those in Tarin Ferry, and wooden docks like thin fingers sticking out into the river. Small boats dotted the Arenal thickly, fishermen hauling their nets. And over it all, the Whitebridge towered and shone.
It looks like glass, Rand said to no one in particular.
Captain Doman paused behind him and tucked his thumbs behind his broad belt.
Nay, lad, whatever it be, it no be glass. Never so hard the rains come, it no be slippery. And the best chisel and the strongest arm no make a mark on it.
A remnant from the age of legends, Tom said. I have always thought it must be.
The captain gave a dour grunt.
Mayhap, but still useful despite. Could be someone else built it. Does no have to be Aes Sedai work, fortune prick me. It no has to be so old as all that. Put your back into it, you bloody fool!
He hurried off down the deck. Rand stared even more wonderingly.
from the Age of Legends. Made by Aes Sedai, then. That was why Captain Doman felt the way he did, for all his talk about the wonder and strangeness of the world. Aes Sedai work. One thing to hear about it, another to see it and touch it. You know that, don't you? For an instant it seemed to Rand that a shadow rippled through the milk-white structure. He pulled his eyes away, to the docks coming nearer. But the bridge still loomed in the corner of his vision. "We made it, Tom," he said, then forced a laugh. "And no mutiny." The gleeman only harumphed and blew out his mustaches, but two sailors readying a cable nearby gave Rand a sharp glance, then bent quickly back to their work. He stopped laughing and tried not to look at the two for the rest of the approach to Whitebridge. The spray curved smoothly in beside the first dock, thick timbers sitting on heavy, tar-coated pilings, and stopped with a backing of oars that swirled the water to froth around the blades. As the oars were drawn in, sailors tossed cables to men on the dock who fastened them off with a flourish, while other crewmen slung the bags of wool over the side to protect the hull from the dock pilings. Before the boat was even pulled snug against the dock, carriages appeared at the end of the dock, tall and lacquered, shiny black, each one with a name painted on the door in large letters, gold or scarlet. The carriage's passengers hurried up the gangplank as soon as it dropped in place. Smooth-faced men in long velvet coats and silk-lined cloaks and cloth slippers, each followed by a plainly dressed servant carrying his iron-bound money box. They approached Captain Doman with painted smiles that slipped when he abruptly roared in their faces.
"You!"
He thrust a thick finger past them, stopping Florin Gelb in his tracks at the length of the boat. The bruise on Gelb's forehead from Rand's boot had faded away, but he still fingered the spot from time to time, as if to remind himself.
"You've slept on watch for the last time on my vessel, or on any vessel if I have my way of it. Choose your own side, the dock or the river, but off my vessel now."
Gelb hunched his shoulders, and his eyes glittered hate at Rand and his friends, at Rand especially, a poisonous glare. The wiry man looked around the deck for support, but there was little hope in that look. One by one, every man in the crew straightened from what he was doing and stared back coldly. Gelb wilted visibly, but then his glare returned, twice as strong as it had been. With a muttered curse, he darted below to the crew's quarters. Doman sent two men after him to see he did no mischief and dismissed him with a grunt. When the captain turned back to them, the merchants took up their smiles and bows as if they had never been interrupted. At a word from Tom, Matt and Rand began gathering their things together. There was not much aside from the clothes on their backs, not for any of them. Rand had his blanket roll and saddlebags and his father's sword. He held the sword for a minute, and homesickness rolled over him so strongly that his eyes stung. He wondered if he would ever see Tam again. Or home. Home. Going to spend the rest of your life running. Running and afraid of your own dreams. With a shuddering sigh, he slipped the belt around his waist over his coat. Gelb came back on deck, followed by his twin shadows. He looked straight ahead, but Rand could still feel hatred coming off him in waves. Back rigid and face dark, Gelb walked stiff-legged down the gangplank and pushed roughly into the thin crowd on the dock. In a minute he was gone from sight, vanished beyond the merchants' carriages. There were not a great many people on the dock, and those were a plainly dressed mix of workmen, fishermen mending nets, and a few townspeople who had come out to see the first boat of the year to come downriver from Saldaea. None of the girls was Egwene, and no one looked the least bit like Moraine or Lan, or anyone else Rand was hoping to see. "Maybe they didn't come down to the dock," he said.
"Maybe," Tom replied curtly.
He settled his instrument cases on his back with care.
"You two keep an eye out for Gelb. He will make trouble if he can. We want to pass through Whitebridge so softly that nobody remembers we were here 5 minutes after we're gone."
Their cloaks flapped in the wind as they walked to the gangplank. Matt carried his bow crossed in front on his chest. Even after all their days in the boat, it still got a few looks from the crewmen. Their bows were short affairs. Captain Doman left the merchants to intercept Tom at the gangplank.
"You believe in me now, Gleeman. Can I not talk you into continuing on? I be going all the way down to Ilion, where folk have a proper regard for Gleeman. There be no finer place in the world for your art. I'd get you there in good time for the Feast of Sifan. The competitions, you know. 100 gold marks for the best telling of the Great Hunt of the Horn.
A great prize, Captain, Tom replied with an elaborate bow and a flourish of his cloak that set the patches to fluttering. And great competitions, which rightly draw Gleeman from the whole world over. But, he added dryly, I fear we could not afford the fare at the rates you charge.
Aye, well, as to that.
The captain produced a leather purse from his coat pocket and tossed it to Tom. It clinked when Tom caught it.
Your fare's back, and a bit more besides. The damage was no so bad as I thought. And you've worked your way and more with your tails and your harp. I could maybe manage as much again if you stay aboard to the Sea of Storms. And I would set you ashore in Ilion. A good gleeman can make his fortune there, even aside from the competitions.
Tom hesitated, weighing the purse on his palm, but Rand spoke up. We're meeting friends here, Captain, and going on to Camelin together. We'll have to see Ilion another time.
Tom's mouth twisted wryly, then he blew out his long mustaches and tucked the purse into his pocket.
Perhaps if the people we are to meet are not here, Captain.
Aye, Doman said sourly. You think on it. Too bad I can no keep Gelb aboard to take the other's anger, but I do what I say I will do. I suppose I must ease up now, even if it means taking 3 times as long to reach Ilion as I should. Well, mayhap those Trollocs whirr after you three.
Rand blinked but kept silent, but Matt was not so cautious.
Why do you think they weren't?
He demanded.
They were after the same treasure we were hunting.
Mayhap,
the captain grunted, sounding unconvinced. He combed thick fingers through his beard, then pointed at the pocket where Tom had put the purse.
Twice that, if you come back to keep the men's minds off how hard I work them. Think on it. I sail with the first light on the morrow.
He turned on his heel and strode back to the merchants, arms spreading wide as he began an apology for keeping them waiting. Tom still hesitated, but Rand hustled him down the gangplank without giving him a chance to argue, and the gleeman let himself be herded. A murmur passed through the people on the dock as they saw Tom's patch-covered cloak, and some called out to discover where he would be performing. So much for not being noticed, Rand thought, dismayed. By sundown, it would be all over Whitebridge that there was a gleeman in town. He hurried Tom along, though, and Tom, wrapped in sulky silence, did not even try to slow down enough to preen under the attention. The carriage drivers looked down at Tom with interest from their high perches, but apparently the dignity of their positions forbade shouting. With no idea of where to go exactly, Rand turned up the street that ran along the river and under the bridge.
"We need to find Moraine and the others," he said, "and fast. We should have thought of changing Tom's cloak."
Tom suddenly shook himself and stopped dead.
"An innkeeper will be able to tell us if they're here, or if they've passed through. The right innkeeper. Innkeepers have all the news and gossip. If they aren't here," he looked back and forth from Rand to Matt, "we have to talk, we three."
Cloak swirling around his ankles, he set off into the town, away from the river. Rand and Matt had to step quickly to keep up. The broad, milk-white arch that gave the town its name dominated Whitebridge as much close up as it did from afar, but once Rand was in the streets he realized that the town was every bit as big as Bearlawn, though not so crowded with people. A few carts moved in the streets, pulled by horse or ox or donkey or man, but no carriages. Those most likely all belonged to the merchants and were clustered down at the dock. Shops of every description lined the streets, and many of the tradesmen worked in front of their establishments, under the signs swinging in the wind. They passed a man mending pots and a tailor holding folds of cloth up to the light for a customer. A shoemaker, sitting in his doorway, tapped his hammer on the heel of a boot. Hawkers cried their services at sharpening knives and scissors, or tried to interest the passer-by in their skimpy trays of fruit or vegetables. But none was getting much interest. Shops selling food had the same pitiful displays of produce Rand remembered from Bearlawn. Even the fishmongers displayed only small piles of small fish for all the boats on the river.
Times were not really hard yet, but everyone could see what was coming if the weather did not change soon. And those faces that were not fixed into worried frowns seemed to stare at something unseen, something unpleasant. Where the White Bridge came down in the center of the town was a big square, paved with stones worn by generations of feet and wagon wheels. Inns surrounded the square, and shops and tall red brick houses with signs out front bearing the same names Rand had seen on the carriages at the dock. It was into one of those inns, seemingly chosen at random, that Tom ducked. The sign over the door, swinging in the wind, had a striding man with a bundle on his back on one side, and the same man with his head on a pillow on the other, and proclaimed, "The Wayfarer's Rest." The common room stood empty except for the fat innkeeper drawing ale from a barrel, and two men in rough workman's clothes, staring glumly into their mugs at a table in the back. Only the innkeeper looked up when they came in. A shoulder-high wall split the room in two from front to back, with tables and a blazing fireplace on each side. Rand wondered idly if all innkeepers were fat and losing their hair. Rubbing his hands together briskly, Tom commented to the innkeeper on the late cold and ordered hot spiced wine, then added quietly, "Is there somewhere my friends and I could talk without being disturbed?" The innkeeper nodded to the low wall.
"The other side, that's as best I've got, unless you want to take a room. For when sailors come up from the river, seems like half the crew's got grudges against the other half. I won't have my place broken up by fights, so I keep them apart."
He had been eyeing Tom's cloak the whole while, and now he cocked his head to one side, a sly look in his eyes.
"You staying? Haven't had a gleeman here in some time. Folks would pay real good for something as would take their minds off things. I'd even take some off on your room and meals."
"Unnoticed," Rand thought glumly.
"You are too generous," Tom said with a smooth bow.
"Perhaps I will take up your offer, but for now, a little privacy."
"I'll bring you wine. Good money here for a gleeman."
The tables on the far side of the wall were all empty, but Tom chose one right in the middle of the space.
"So no one can listen without us knowing," he explained. "Did you hear that fellow? He'll take some off. Why, I'd double his custom just by sitting here. Any honest innkeeper gives a gleeman room and board and a good bit besides."
The bare table was none too clean, and the floor had not been swept in days, if not weeks. Rand looked around and grimaced. Master Alvear would not have let his inn get that dirty if he had had to climb out of a sickbed to see to it.
"We're only after information, remember?"
"Why here?" Matt demanded. "We passed other inns that looked cleaner."
"Straight on from the bridge," Tom said, "is the road to Camelin. Anyone passing through Whitebridge comes through this square, unless they're going by river, and we know your friends aren't doing that. If there is no word of them here, it doesn't exist. Let me do the talking. This has to be done carefully."
Just then the innkeeper appeared, three battered pewter mugs gripped in one fist by the handles. The fat man flicked at the table with a towel, set the mugs down, and took Tom's money.
"If you stay, you won't have to pay for your drinks. Good wine here."
Tom's smile touched only his mouth.
"I will think on it, innkeeper. What news is there? We have been away from hearing things. Big news, that's what. Big news."
The innkeeper draped the towel over his shoulder and pulled up a chair. He crossed his arms on the table, took root with a long sigh, saying what a comfort it was to get off his feet. His name was Bartim, and he went on about his feet in detail, about corns and bunions and how much time he spent standing and what he soaked them in, until Tom mentioned the news again, and then he shifted over with hardly a pause. The news was just as big as he said it was. Loghain, the false dragon, had been captured after a big battle near Lugard, while he was trying to move his army from Giladan to Tyr. The prophecies, they understood. Tom nodded, and Bartim went on. The roads in the south were packed with people, the lucky ones, with what they could carry on their backs. Thousands fleeing in all directions.
"None," Bartim chuckled wryly, "supported Loghain, of course. Oh, no, you won't find many to admit to that, not now. Just refugees trying to find a safe place during the Troubles."
Aes Sedai had been involved in taking Loghain, of course. Bartim spat on the floor when he said that, and again when he said they were taking the false dragon north to Tar Valon. Bartim was a decent man, he said, a respectable man, and Aes Sedai could all go back to the Blight where they came from and take Tar Valon with them, as far as he was concerned. He would get no closer to an Aes Sedai than 1,000 miles if he had his way. Of course, they were stopping at every village and town on the way north to display Loghain, so he had heard. To show people that the false dragon had been taken, and the world was safe again. He would have liked to see that, even if it did mean getting close to Aes Sedai. He was halfway tempted to go to Camelin.
"They'll be taking him there to show to Queen Morgaze," the innkeeper touched his forehead respectfully. "I've never seen the queen. Man ought to see his own queen, don't you think?"
Loghain could do things, and the way Bartim's eyes shifted and his tongue darted across his lips made it clear what he meant. He had seen the last false dragon, 2 years ago, when he was paraded through the countryside, but that was just some fellow who thought he could make himself a king. There had been no need for Aes Sedai that time. Soldiers had had him chained up on a wagon, a sullen-looking fellow who moaned in the middle of the wagon bed, covering his head with his arms whenever people threw stones or poked him with sticks. There had been a lot of that, and the soldiers had done nothing to stop it, as long as they did not kill the fellow. Best to let the people see he was nothing special after all. He could not do things. This Loghain would be something to see, though. Something for Bartim to tell his grandchildren about. If only the inn would let him get away. Rand listened with an interest that did not have to be faked. When Padan Fain had brought word to Emmonsfield of a false dragon, a man actually wielding the power, it had been the biggest news to come into the Two Rivers in years. What had happened since had pushed it to the back of his mind, but it was still the sort of thing people would be talking about for years and telling their grandchildren about, too. Bartim would probably tell his that he had seen Loghain, whether he did or not. Nobody would ever think what happened to some village folk from the Two Rivers was worth talking about, not unless they were Two Rivers people themselves.
"That," Tom said, "would be something to make a story of. A story they'd tell for 1,000 years. I wish I had been there."
He sounded as if it was the simple truth, and Rand thought it really was.
"I might try to see him anyway. You didn't say what route they were taking. Perhaps there are some travelers around. They might have heard the route."
Bartim waved a grubby hand dismissively.
"North, that's all anybody knows around here. You want to see him? Go to Camelin, that's all I know. And if there's anything to know in Whitebridge, I know it."
"No doubt you do," Tom said smoothly. "I expect a lot of strangers passing through stop here. Your sign caught my eye from the foot of the Whitebridge."
"Not just from the west, I'll have you know. 2 days ago there was a fellow in here, an Ilianer, with a proclamation all done up with seals and ribbons. Read it right out there in the square. Said he's taking it all the way to the Mountains of Mist, maybe even to the Arith Ocean, if the passes are open. Said they've sent men to read it in every land in the world."
The innkeeper shook his head.
"The Mountains of Mist. I hear they're covered with fog all the year round, and there's things in the fog will strip the flesh off your bones before you can run."
Matt snickered, earning a sharp look from Bartim. Tom leaned forward intently.
"What did the proclamation say?"
"Why, the hunt for the horn, of course," Bartim exclaimed. "Didn't I say that? The Ilioners are calling on everybody, as will swear their lives to the hunt, to gather an Ilion." "Can you imagine that? Swearing your life to a legend? I suppose they'll find some fools. There's always fools around. This fellow claimed the end of the world is coming. The last battle with the Dark One."
He chuckled, but it had a hollow sound. A man laughing to convince himself something really was worth laughing at.
"Guess they think the Horn of Valir has to be found before it happens. Now what do you think of that?"
He chewed a knuckle pensively for a minute.
"Course I don't know as I could argue with them after this winter. The winter, and this fellow Loghain, and those other two before as well. Why all these fellows the last few years claiming to be the dragon? And the winter must mean something. What do you think?"
Tom did not seem to hear him. In a soft voice, the gleeman began to recite to himself.
In the last lone fight, against the fall of long night, the mountains stand guard, and the dead shall be ward, for the grave is no bar to my call.
That's it!
Bartom grinned, as if he could already see the crowds handing him their money while they listened to Tom.
That's it! The great hunt of the horn! You tell that one, and they'll be hanging from the rafters in here. Everybody's heard about the proclamation.
Tom still seemed to be 1,000 miles away, so Rand said, We're looking for some friends who are coming this way. From the west. Have there been many strangers passing through in the last week or two?
Some, Bartom said slowly. There's always some, from east and west both.
He looked at each of them in turn, suddenly wary.
What do they look like, these friends of yours?
Rand opened his mouth, but Tom, abruptly back from wherever he had been, gave him a sharp, silencing look. With an exasperated sigh, the gleeman turned to the innkeeper.
2 men and 3 women, he said reluctantly. They may be together or maybe not.
He gave thumbnail sketches, painting each one in just a few words, enough for anyone who had seen them to recognize without giving away anything about who they were. Bartom rubbed one hand over his head, disarranging his thinning hair, and stood up slowly.
Forget about performing here, Gleeman. In fact, I'd appreciate it if you drank your wine and left. Leave Whitebridge if you're smart.
Someone else has been asking after them?
Tom took a drink, as if the answer were the least important thing in the world, and raised an eyebrow at the innkeeper.
Who would that be?
Bartom scrubbed his hand through his hair again, and shifted his feet on the point of walking away, then nodded to himself.
About 1 week ago, as near as I can say, a weaselly fellow came over the bridge. Crazy, everybody thought. Always talking to himself, never stopped moving even when he was standing still. Asked about the same people. Some of them. He asked like it was important, then acted like he didn't care what the answer was. Half the time he was saying, as he had to wait here for them, and the other half, as he had to go on, he was in a hurry. 1 minute he was whining and begging, the next making demands like a king. Near got himself a thrashing a time or two, crazy or not. The watch almost took him in custody for his own safety. He went off toward Camelin that same day, talking to himself and crying. Crazy, like I said.
Rand looked at Tom and Matt questioningly, and they both shook their heads. If this weaselly fellow was looking for them, he was still nobody they recognized. Are you sure it was the same people he wanted? Rand asked.
Some of them. The fighting man and the woman in silk. But it wasn't them as he cared about. It was 3 country boys.
His eyes slid across Rand and Matt and away again so fast that Rand was not sure if he had really seen the look or imagined it.
He was desperate to find them. But crazy, like I said.
Rand shivered and wondered who the crazy man could be and why he was looking for them. A dark friend? Would Baal-Zamun use a madman?
He was crazy. But the other one...
Bartom's eyes shifted uneasily and his tongue ran over his lips as if he could not find enough spit to moisten them.
Next day the other one came for the first time.
He fell silent.
The other one?
Tom prompted finally. Bartom looked around, although their side of the divided room was still empty except for them. He even raised up on his toes and looked over the low wall. When he finally spoke, it was in a whispered rush.
All in black he is. Keeps the hood of his cloak pulled up so you can't see his face, but you can feel him looking at you. Feel it like an icicle shoved into your spine. He spoke to me.
He flinched and stopped to chew at his lip before going on.
Sounded like a snake crawling through dead leaves. Fair turned my stomach to ice. Every time as he comes back, he asks the same questions. Same questions the crazy man asked. Nobody ever sees him coming. He's just there all of a sudden, day or night, freezing you where you stand. People are starting to look over their shoulders. Worst of it is, the gate tenders claim as he's never passed through any of the gates, coming or going.
Rand worked at keeping his face blank.
He clenched his jaw until his teeth ached. Matt scowled, and Tom studied his wine. The word none of them wanted to say hung in the air between them. Murdrawl.
I think I'd remember if I ever met anyone like that, Tom said after a minute.
Bardem's head bobbed furiously.
Burn me, but you would. Light's truth, you would. He wants the same lot as the crazy man, only he said as there's a girl with him, and...
He glanced sideways at Tom.
And a white-haired gleeman.
Tom's eyebrows shot up in what Rand was sure was unfeigned surprise.
A white-haired gleeman? Well, I'm hardly the only gleeman in the world with a little age on him. I assure you I don't know this fellow, and he can have no reason to be looking for me.
That's as may be, Bartom said glumly. He didn't say it in so many words, but I got the impression as he would be very displeased with anyone as tried to help these people or tried to hide them from him. Anyway, I'll tell you what I told him. I haven't seen any of them, nor heard tell of them, and that's the truth. Not any of them, he finished pointedly.
Abruptly, he slapped Tom's money down on the table.
Just finish your wine and go. All right, all right.
And he trundled away as fast as he could, looking over his shoulder.
A fade, Matt breathed when the innkeeper was gone. I should have known they'd be looking for us here.
And he'll be back, Tom said, leaning across the table and lowering his voice. I say we sneak back to the boat and take Captain Doman up on his offer. The hunt will center on the road to Camelin, while we're on our way to Ilion, 1,000 miles from where the Murdrawl expect us.
No, Rand said firmly. We wait for Moraine and the others in Whitebridge, or we go on to Camelin. One or the other, Tom. That's what we decided.
That's crazed, boy. Things have changed. You listen to me. No matter what this innkeeper says, when a Murdrawl stares at him, he'll tell all about us, down to what we had to drink and how much dust we had on our boots.
Rand shivered, remembering the Fade's eyeless stare.
As for Camelin... You think the Halfmen don't know you want to get to Tar Valon? It's a good time to be on a boat headed south.
No, Tom.
Rand had to force the words out, thinking of being 1,000 miles from where the Fades were looking, but he took a deep breath and managed to firm his voice.
No.
Think, boy. Ilion. There isn't a grander city on the face of the earth, and the great Hunt of the Horn. There hasn't been a Hunt of the Horn in near 400 years. A whole new cycle of stories waiting to be made. Just think. You never dreamed of anything like it. By the time the Murdrawl figure out where you've gone to, you'll be old and gray and so tired of watching your grandchildren you won't care if they do find you.
Rand's face took on a stubborn set.
How many times do I have to say no? They'll find us wherever we go. There'd be Fades waiting in Ilion, too. And how do we escape the dreams? I want to know what's happening to me, Tom, and why. I'm going to Tar Valon. With Moraine, if I can. Without her, if I have to. Alone, if I have to. I need to know.
But Ilion, boy! And a safe way out, downriver, while they're looking for you in another direction. Blood and ashes, a dream can't hurt you.
Rand kept silent.
A dream can't hurt? Do dream thorns draw real blood?
He almost wished he had told Tom about that dream, too.
Do you dare tell anybody? Balsamon is in your dreams, but what's between dreaming and waking now? Who do you dare to tell that the Dark One is touching you?
Tom seemed to understand. The gleeman's face softened.
Even those dreams, lad. They are still just dreams, aren't they?
For the light's sake, Matt, talk to him. I know you don't want to go to Tar Valon, at least.
Matt's face reddened, half embarrassment and half anger. He avoided looking at Rand and scowled at Tom instead.
Why are you going to all this fuss and bother? You want to go back to the boat? Go back to the boat. We'll take care of ourselves.
The gleeman's thin shoulders shook with silent laughter, but his voice was anger-tight.
You think you know enough about Murdrawl to escape by yourself, do you?
You're ready to walk into Tar Valon alone and hand yourself over to the Ammerlin seat? Can you even tell one Aja from another? The light burn me, boy. If you think you can even get to Tar Valon alone, you tell me to go.
Go,
Matt growled,
sliding a hand under his cloak. Rand realized with a shock that he was gripping the dagger from Shadar Logoth, maybe even ready to use it. Raucous laughter broke out on the other side of the low wall dividing the room, and a scornful voice spoke up loudly.
"Trollix! Put on a gleeman's cloak, man! You're drunk! Trollix! Borderland fables!"
The words doused anger like a pot of cold water. Even Matt half turned to the wall, eyes widening. Rand stood just enough to see over the wall, then ducked back down again with a sinking feeling in his stomach. Florin Gelb sat on the other side of the wall, at the table in the back, with the two men who had been there when they came in. They were laughing at him, but they were listening. Bardem was wiping a table that badly needed it, not looking at Gelb and the two men. But he was listening, too, scrubbing one spot over and over with his towel, and leaning toward them until he seemed almost ready to fall over.
"Gelb,"
Rand whispered as he dropped back into his chair, and the others tensed. Tom swiftly studied their side of the room. On the other side of the wall, the second man's voice chimed in.
"No, no, there used to be Trollocs, but they killed them all in the Trolloc Wars." "Borderland fables,"
the first man repeated.
"It's true, I tell you," Gelb protested loudly. "I've been in the Borderlands. I've seen Trollocs, and these were Trollocs as sure as I'm sitting here. Those three claimed the Trollocs were chasing them, but I know better. That's why I wouldn't stay on the spray. I've had my suspicions about Bale Doman for some time, but those three are dark friends for sure. I tell you—"
Laughter and coarse jokes drowned out the rest of what Gelb had to say. How long, Rand wondered, before the innkeeper heard a description of those three, if he had not already, if he did not just leap to the three strangers he had already seen. The only door from their half of the common room would take them right past Gelb's table.
"Maybe the boat isn't such a bad idea," Matt muttered, but Tom shook his head.
"Not anymore." The gleeman spoke softly and fast. He pulled out the leather purse Captain Doman had given him and hastily divided the money into three piles. "That story will be all through the town in an hour, whether anybody believes it or not, and the half-men could hear any time. Doman isn't sailing until tomorrow morning. At best, he'll have Trollocs chasing him all the way to Ilion. Well, he's half expecting it for some reason, but that won't do us any good. There's nothing for it but to run, and run hard." Matt quickly stuffed the coins Tom shoved in front of him into his pocket. Rand picked his pile up more slowly. The coin Moraine had given him was not among them. Doman had given an equal weight of silver, but Rand, for some reason he could not fathom, wished he had the Aes Sedai's coin instead. Stuffing the money in his pocket, he looked a question at the gleeman.
"In case we're separated," Tom explained. "We probably won't be, but if it does happen, well, you two will make out all right by yourselves. You're good lads. Just keep clear of Aes Sedai. For your lives."
"I thought you were staying with us."
"I am, boy, I am. But they're getting close now, and the light only knows. Well, no matter. It isn't likely anything will happen."
Tom paused, looking at Matt.
"I hope you no longer mind me staying with you," he said dryly.
Matt shrugged. He eyed each of them, then shrugged again.
"I'm just on edge. I can't seem to get rid of it. Every time we stop for a breath, they're there, hunting us. I feel like somebody's staring at the back of my head all the time. What are we going to do?"
The laughter erupted on the other side of the wall, broken again by Gelb trying loudly to convince the two men that he was telling the truth. How much longer, Rand wondered. Sooner or later, Bartim had to put together Gelb's three and the three of them. Tom eased his chair and rose, but kept his height crouched. No one looking casually toward the wall from the other side could see him. He motioned for them to follow, whispering,
"Be very quiet."
The windows on either side of the fireplace, on their side of the wall, looked out into an alleyway. Tom studied one of the windows carefully before drawing it up just enough for them to squeeze through. It barely made a sound, nothing that could have been heard 3 feet away over the laughing argument on the other side of the low wall. Once in the alley, Matt started for the street right away, but Tom caught his arm.
"Not so fast," the gleeman told him. "Not till we know what we're doing."
Tom lowered the window again, as much as he could from outside, and turned to study the alley. Rand followed Tom's eyes. Except for half a dozen rain barrels against the inn and the next building, a tailor shop, the alley was empty, the hard-packed dirt dry and dusty.
"Why are you doing this?" Matt demanded again. "You'd be safer if you left us. Why are you staying with us?"
Tom stared at him for a long moment.
"I had a nephew, Owen," he said wearily, shrugging out of his cloak. He made a pile of his blanket roll as he talked, carefully setting his cased instruments on top. "My brother's only son, my only living kin. He got in trouble with the Aes Sedai, but I was too busy with other things. I don't know what I could have done, but when I finally tried, it was too late. Owen died a few years later. You could say Aes Sedai killed him."
He straightened up, not looking at them. His voice was still level, but Rand glimpsed tears in his eyes as he turned his head away.
"If I can keep you two free of Tar Valon, maybe I can stop thinking about Owen. Wait here."
Still avoiding their eyes, he hurried to the mouth of the alley, slowing before he reached it. After one quick look around, he strolled casually into the street and out of sight. Matt half rose to follow, then settled back.
"He won't leave these," he said, touching the leather instrument cases. "You believe that story?"
Rand squatted patiently beside the rain barrels.
"What's the matter with you, Matt? You aren't like this. I haven't heard you laugh in days." "I don't like being hunted like a rabbit," Matt snapped.
He sighed, letting his head fall back against the brick wall of the inn. Even like that, he seemed tense. His eyes shifted warily.
"Sorry. It's the running, and all these strangers, and just everything. It makes me jumpy. I look at somebody and I can't help wondering if he's going to tell the Fades about us, or cheat us, or rob us, or... Light, Rand, doesn't it make you nervous?"
Rand laughed, a quick bark in the back of his throat.
"I'm too scared to be nervous." "What do you think the Aes Sedai did to his nephew?"
"I don't know," Rand said uneasily. There was only one kind of trouble that he knew of for a man to get into with Aes Sedai.
"Not like us, I guess." "No, not like us."
For a time they leaned against the wall, not talking. Rand was not sure how long they waited. A few minutes, probably, but it felt like an hour waiting for Tom to come back, waiting for Bartim and Gelb to open the window and denounce them for dark friends. Then a man turned in at the mouth of the alley, a tall man with the hood of his cloak pulled up to hide his face, a cloak black as night against the light of the street. Rand scrambled to his feet, one hand wrapped around the hilt of Tam's sword so hard that his knuckles hurt. His mouth went dry, and no amount of swallowing helped. Matt rose to a crouch with one hand under his cloak. The man came closer, and Rand's throat grew tighter with every step. Abruptly, the man stopped and tossed back his cowl. Rand's knees almost gave way. It was Tom.
"Well, if you don't recognize me," the gleeman grinned, "I guess it's a good enough disguise for the gates."
Tom pushed past them and began transferring things from his patch-covered cloak to his new one so nimbly that Rand could not make out any of them. The new cloak was dark brown, Rand saw now. He drew a deep, ragged breath. His throat still felt as if it were clutched in a fist. Brown, not black. Matt still had his hand under his cloak, and he stared at Tom's back as if he were thinking of using the hidden dagger. Tom glanced up at them, then gave them a sharper look.
"This is no time to get skittish."
Deftly, he began folding his old cloak into a bundle around his instrument cases, inside out so the patches were hidden.
"We'll walk out of here one at a time, just close enough to keep each other in sight. Shouldn't be remembered especially that way." "Can't you slouch?" he added to Rand. "That height of yours is as bad as a banner."
He slung the bundle across his back and stood, drawing his hood back up. He looked nothing like a white-haired gleeman. He was just another traveler, a man too poor to afford a horse, much less a carriage.
"Let's go. We've wasted too much time already."
Rand agreed fervently, but even so he hesitated before stepping out of the alley into the square. None of the sparse scattering of people gave them a second look. Most did not look at them at all, but his shoulders knotted, waiting for the cry of Dark Friend that could turn ordinary people into a mob bent on murder. He ran his eyes across the open area, over people moving about on their daily business, and when he brought them back, a murdrawl was halfway across the square. Where the fate had come from, he could not begin to guess, but it strode toward the three of them with a slow deadliness, a predator with the prey under its gaze. People shied away from the black-cloaked shape, avoided looking at it. The square began to empty out as people decided they were needed elsewhere. The black cowl froze Rand where he stood. He tried to summon up the void, but it was like fumbling after smoke. The fade's hidden gaze knifed to his bones and turned his marrow to icicles.
"Don't look at its face," Tom muttered. His voice shook and cracked, and it sounded as if he were forcing the words out. "The light burn you, don't look at its face!"
Rand tore his eyes away. He almost groaned. It felt like tearing a leech off of his face. But even staring at the stones of the square, he could still see the murderer coming. A cat playing with mice, amused at their feeble efforts to escape, until finally the jaws snapped shut. The fade had halved the distance.
"Are we just going to stand here?" he mumbled. "We have to run. Get away."
But he could not make his feet move. Matt had the ruby-hilted dagger out at last in a trembling hand. His lips were drawn back from his teeth, a snarl, and a rictus of fear.
"Think," Tom stopped to swallow, and went on hoarsely. "Think you can outrun it, do you, boy?"
He began to mutter to himself. The only word Rand could make out was Owen. Abruptly, Tom growled.
"I never should have gotten mixed up with you boys. Should never have."
He shrugged the bundled Gleeman's cloak off of his back and thrust it into Rand's arms.
"Take care of that. When I say run, you run and don't stop until you get to Camelon. The Queen's blessing, an inn. Remember that, in case... Just remember it."
"I don't understand," Rand said.
The murdrawl was not 20 paces away now. His feet felt like lead weights.
"Just remember it," Tom snarled. "The Queen's blessing. Now, run!"
He gave them a push, one hand on the shoulder of each of them, to get them started, and Rand stumbled away in a lurching run with Matt at his side.
"Run!"
Tom sprang into motion, too, with a long, wordless roar. Not after them, but toward the murdrawl. His hands flourished, as if he were performing at his best, and daggers appeared. Rand stopped, but Matt pulled him along. The fade was just as startled. Its leisurely pace faltered in mid-stride. Its hand swept toward the hilt of the black sword hanging at its waist, but the Gleeman's long legs covered the distance quickly. Tom crashed into the murdrawl before the black blade was half-drawn, and both went down in a thrashing heap. The few people still in the square fled.
"Run!"
The air in the square flashed an eye-searing blue, and Tom began to scream. But in the middle of the scream, he managed a word.
"Run!"
Rand obeyed. The Gleeman's screams pursued him. Clutching Tom's bundle to his chest, he ran as hard as he could. Panic spread from the square out through the town as Rand and Matt fled on the crest of a wave of fear. Shopkeepers abandoned their goods as the boys passed. Shutters banged down over storefronts, and frightened faces appeared in the windows of houses, then vanished. People who had not been close enough to see ran through the streets wildly, paying no heed. They bumped into one another, and those who were knocked down scrambled to their feet or were trampled. Whitebridge roiled like a kicked anthill. As he and Matt pounded toward the gates, Rand abruptly remembered what Tom had said about his height. Without slowing down, he crouched as best he could without looking as if he were crouching. But the gates themselves, thick wood bound with black iron straps, stood open. The two gate-tenders in steel caps and mail tunics worn over cheap-looking red coats with white collars fingered their halberds and stared uneasily into the town. One of them glanced at Rand and Matt, but they were not the only ones running out of the gates. A steady stream boiled through, panting men clutching wives, weeping women carrying babes and dragging crying children, pale-faced craftsmen still in their aprons, still heedlessly gripping their tools. There would be no one who could tell which way they had gone, Rand thought as he ran, dazed.
"Tom. Oh, light, save me, Tom."
Matt staggered beside him, caught his balance, and they ran until the last of the fleeing people had fallen away, ran until the town and the white bridge were far out of sight behind them.
Finally, Rand fell to his knees in the dust, pulling air raggedly into his raw throat with great gulps. The road behind stretched empty until it was lost to sight among bare trees. Matt plucked at him.
"Come on! Come on!"
Matt panted the words. Sweat and dust streaked his face, and he looked ready to collapse.
"We have to keep going!"
"Tom," Rand said. He tightened his arms around the bundle of Tom's cloak. The instrument cases were hard lumps inside.
"Tom, he's dead. You saw, you heard. Light, Rand, he's dead."
"You think Egwene and Moraine and the rest are dead, too. If they're dead, why are the Murdral still hunting them? Answer me that." Matt dropped to his knees in the dust beside him.
"All right, maybe they are alive. But Tom, you saw. Blood and ashes, Rand, the same thing can happen to us."
Rand nodded slowly. The road behind them was still empty. He had been halfway expecting, hoping at least, to see Tom appear, striding along, blowing out his mustaches to tell them how much trouble they were. "The Queen's blessing in Camelon." He struggled to his feet and slung Tom's bundle on his back alongside his blanket roll. Matt stared up at him, narrow-eyed and wary.
"Let's go," Rand
said, and started down the road toward Camelon. He heard Matt muttering, and after a moment, he caught up to Rand. They trudged along the dusty road, heads down and not talking. The wind spawned dust devils that whirled across their path. Sometimes Rand looked back, but the road behind was always empty. Chapter 27 Shelter from the Storm. Perrin fretted over the days spent with the Tuathoan, traveling south and east in a leisurely fashion. The traveling people saw no need to hurry. They never did. The colorful wagons did not roll out of a morning until the sun was well above the horizon, and they stopped as early as mid-afternoon if they came across a congenial spot. The dogs trotted easily alongside the wagons, and often the children did too. They had no difficulty in keeping up. Any suggestion that they might go further, or more quickly, was met with laughter, or perhaps, "Ah, but would you make the poor horses work so hard?" He was surprised that Elias did not share his feelings. Elias would not ride in the wagons. He preferred to walk, sometimes loping along at the head of the column. But he never suggested leaving or pressing on ahead. The strange bearded man in his strange skin clothes was so different from the gentle Tuathoan that he stood out whenever he went among the wagons. Even from across the camp, there was no mistaking Elias for one of the people, and not just because of clothes. Elias moved with the lazy grace of a wolf, only emphasized by his skins and his fur hat, radiating danger as naturally as a fire radiated heat, and the contrast with the traveling people was sharp. Young and old, the people were joyful on their feet. There was no danger in their grace, only delight. Their children darted about, filled with the pure zest of moving, of course, but among the Tuathoan, graybeards and grandmothers, too, still stepped lightly, their walk a stately dance no less exuberant for its dignity. All the people seemed on the point of dancing, even when standing still, even during the rare times when there was no music in the camp. Fiddles and flutes, dulcimers and zithers, and drums spun harmony and counterpoint among the wagons at almost any hour, in camp or on the move. Joyous songs, merry songs, laughing songs, sad songs. If someone was awake in the camp, there was usually music. Elias met friendly nods and smiles at every wagon he passed, and a cheerful word at any fire where he paused. This must be the face the people always showed to outsiders. Open, smiling faces. But Perrin had learned that hidden beneath the surface was the wariness of a half-tamed deer. Something deep lay behind the smiles directed at the Emmonsfielders, something that wondered if they were safe, something that faded only slightly over the days. With Elias, the wariness was strong, like deep summer heat shimmering in the air, and it did not fade. When he was not looking, they watched him openly, as if unsure what he was going to do. When he walked across the camp, feet ready for dancing, seemed ready for flight as well. Elias was certainly no more comfortable with their way of the leaf than they were with him. His mouth wore a permanent twist when he was around the Tuathoan. It was not quite condescension, and certainly not contempt,
but looked as though he would rather be elsewhere than where he was. Almost anywhere else. Yet whenever Perrin brought up leaving, Elias made soothing noises about resting, just for a few days.
"You had hard days before you met me," Elias said, the third or fourth time he asked. "And you'll have harder still ahead, with Trollocs and Halfmen after you, and Aes Sedai for friends."
He grinned around a mouthful of Ela's dried apple pie. Perrin still found his yellow-eyed gaze disconcerting, even when he was smiling. Perhaps even more when he was smiling. Smiles seldom touched those hunters' eyes. Elias lounged beside Rain's fire, as usual refusing to sit on the logs drawn up for the purpose.
"Don't be in such a bloody hurry to put yourself in Aes Sedai hands."
"What if the Fades find us? What's to keep them from it if we just sit here waiting? Three wolves can't hold them off, and the traveling people won't be any help. They won't even defend themselves. The Trollocs will butcher them, and it will be our fault. Anyway, we have to leave them sooner or later. It might as well be sooner."
"Something tells me to wait. Just a few days."
"Something."
"Relax, lad. Take life as it comes. Run when you have to. Fight when you must. Rest when you can."
"What are you talking about? Something."
"Have some of this pie. Ela doesn't like me, but she surely feeds me well when I visit. Always good food in the people's camps."
"What something?" Perrin demanded. "If you know something, you aren't telling the rest of us."
Elias frowned at the piece of pie in his hand, then set it down and dusted his hands together.
"Something," he said finally, with a shrug of his shoulders, as if he did not understand it completely himself. "Something tells me it's important to wait. A few more days. I don't get feelings like this often, but when I do, I've learned to trust them. They've saved my life in the past. This time it's different somehow, but it's important. That's clear. You want to run on? Then run on. Not me."
That was all he would say, no matter how many times Perrin asked. He lay about, talking with Rain, eating, napping with his hat over his eyes, and refused to discuss leaving. Something told him to wait. Something told him it was important. He would know when it was time to go. "Have some pie, lad. Don't lather yourself. Try some of this stew. Relax." Perrin could not make himself relax. At night he wandered among the rainbow wagons, worrying, as much because no one else seemed to see anything to worry about, as for any other reason. The Tuathoan sang and danced, cooked and ate around their campfires, fruits and nuts, berries and vegetables, they ate no meat, and went about a myriad domestic chores, as if they had not a care in the world. The children ran and played everywhere, hide-and-seek among the wagons, climbing in the trees around the camp, laughing and rolling on the ground with the dogs. Not a care in the world for anyone. Watching them, he itched to get away.
"Go before we bring the hunters down on them. They took us in, and we repay their kindness by endangering them. At least they have reason to be light-hearted. Nothing is hunting them. But the rest of us..."
It was hard to get a word with Egwene. Either she was talking with Ela, their heads together in a way that said no men were welcome, or she was dancing with Aram, swinging around and round to the flutes and fiddles and drums, to the tunes the Tuathoan had gathered from all over the world, or to the sharp, trilling songs of the traveling people themselves. Sharp, whether they were quick or slow. They knew many songs, some he recognized from home, though often under different names than they were called in the Two Rivers. Three girls in the meadow, for instance, the tinkers named Pretty Maids Dancing, and they said the wind from the north was called Hard Rain Falling in some lands, and Baron's Retreat in others. When he asked, not thinking, for "The Tinker Has My Pots," they fell all over themselves laughing. They knew it, but as "Toss the Feathers." He could understand wanting to dance to the people's songs. Back in Emmons Field, no one considered him more than an adequate dancer, but these songs tugged at his feet, and he thought he had never danced so long or so hard or so well in his life. Hypnotic, they made his blood pound in rhythm to the drums. It was the second evening when, for the first time, Perrin saw women dance to some of the slow songs. The fires burned low, and the night hung close around the wagons, and fingers tapped a slow rhythm on the drums. First one drum, then another, until every drum in the camp kept the same low, insistent beat. There was silence except for the drums. A girl in a red dress swayed into the light, loosening her shawl. Strings of beads hung in her hair, and she had kicked off her shoes. A flute began the melody, wailing softly, and the girl danced. Outstretched arms spread under her shawl behind her. Her hips undulated as her bare feet shuffled to the beat of the drums. The girl's dark eyes fastened on Perrin, and her smile was as slow as her dance. She turned in small circles, smiling over her shoulder at him. He swallowed hard. The heat in his face was not from the fire. A second girl joined the first, the fringe on their shawls shaking in time to the drums and the slow rotation of their hips. They smiled at him, and he cleared his throat hoarsely. He was afraid to look around. His face was as red as a beet, and anyone who was not watching the dancers was probably laughing at him. He was sure of it. As casually as he could manage, he slid off the log as if he were just getting comfortable. But he carefully ended up looking away from the fire, away from the dancers. There was nothing like that in Emmons Field. Dancing with the girls on the green on a feast day did not even come close. For once he wished the wind would pick up to cool him off. The girls danced into his field of view again, only now they were three. One gave him a sly wink. His eyes darted frantically.
Light, he thought. What do I do now? What would Rand do? He knows about girls.
The dancing girls laughed softly. Beads clicked as they tossed their long hair on their shoulders, and he thought his face would burn up. Then a slightly older woman joined the girls to show them how it was done. With a groan, he gave up altogether and shut his eyes. Even behind his eyelids, their laughter taunted and tickled. Even behind his eyelids, he could still see them. Sweat beaded on his forehead, and he wished for the wind. According to Rain, the girls did not dance that dance often, and the women rarely did, and according to Elias, it was thanks to Perrin's blushes that they did so every night thereafter.
I have to thank you, Elias told him, his tone sober and solemn. It's different with you young fellows, but at my age it takes more than a fire to warm my bones.
Perrin scowled. There was something about Elias's back as he walked away that said even if nothing showed, he was laughing inside. Perrin soon learned better than to look away from the dancing women and girls, though the winks and smiles still made him wish he could. One would have been all right, maybe, but five or six, with everyone watching? He never did entirely conquer his blushes. Then Egwene began learning the dance. Two of the girls who had danced that first night taught her, clapping the rhythm while she repeated the shuffling steps with a borrowed shawl swaying behind her. Perrin started to say something, then decided it was wiser not to crack his teeth. When the girls added the hip movements, Egwene started laughing, and the three girls fell giggling into one another's arms. But Egwene persevered, with her eyes glistening and bright spots of color in her cheeks. Aram watched her dancing with a hot, hungry gaze. The handsome young Tuathuan had given her a string of blue beads that she wore all the time. Worried frowns now replaced the smiles Ela had worn when she first noticed her grandson's interest in Egwene. Perrin resolved to keep a close eye on young Master Aram. Once he managed to get Egwene alone, beside a wagon painted in green and yellow. "Enjoying yourself, aren't you?" he said.
"Why shouldn't I?"
She fingered the blue beads around her neck, smiling at them.
"We don't all have to work at being miserable the way you do. Don't we deserve a little chance to enjoy ourselves?"
Aram stood not far off. He never got far off from Egwene. With his arms folded across his chest, a little smile on his face, half smugness and half challenge. Perrin lowered his voice.
"I thought you wanted to get to Tar Valon. You won't learn to be an Aes Sedai here."
Egwene tossed her head.
"And I thought you didn't like me wanting to become an Aes Sedai," she said, too sweetly. "Blood and ashes! Do you believe we're safe here? Are these people safe with us here? A fade could find us any time."
Her hand trembled on the beads. She lowered it and took a deep breath.
"Whatever is going to happen will happen, whether we leave today or next week. That's what I believe now." Enjoy yourself, Perrin. It might be the last chance we have.
She brushed his cheek sadly with her fingers. Then Aram held out his hand to her, and she darted to him, already laughing again. As they ran away to where fiddles sang, Aram flashed a triumphant grin over his shoulder at Perrin, as if to say, "She is not yours, but she will be mine." They were all falling too much under the spell of the people, Perrin thought.
Elias is right. They don't have to try to convert you to the way of the leaf. It seeps into you.
Hela had taken one look at him huddling out of the wind, then produced a thick wool cloak out of her wagon. A dark green cloak, he was pleased to see, after all the reds and yellows. As he swung it round his shoulders, thinking what a wonder it was that the cloak was big enough for him, Hela said primly,
"It could fit better."
She glanced at the axe at his belt, and when she looked up at him, her eyes were sad above her smile.
"It could fit much better."
All the tinkers did that. Their smiles never slipped. There was never any hesitation in their invitations to join them for a drink or to listen to the music, but their eyes always touched the axe, and he could feel what they thought. A tool of violence. There is never any excuse for violence to another human being. The way of the leaf. Sometimes he wanted to shout at them. There were Trollocs in the world, and Fades. There were those who would cut down every leaf. The Dark One was out there, and the way of the leaf would burn in Balsamon's eyes. Stubbornly, he continued to wear the axe. He took to keeping his cloak thrown back, even when it was windy, so the half-moon blade was never hidden. Now and again, Elias looked quizzically at the weapon hanging heavy at his side and grinned at him, those yellow eyes seeming to read his mind. That almost made him cover the axe. Almost. If the Tuathuan camp was a source of constant irritation, at least his dreams were normal there. Sometimes he woke up sweating from a dream of Trollocs and Fades storming into the camp, rainbow-colored wagons turning to bonfires from hurled torches, people falling in pools of blood, men and women and children who ran and screamed and died but made no effort to defend themselves against slashing, scythe-like swords. Night after night he bolted upright in the dark, panting and reaching for his axe before he realized the wagons were not in flames, that no bloody-muzzled shapes snarled over torn and twisted bodies littering the ground. But those were ordinary nightmares, and oddly comforting in their way. If there was ever a place for the Dark One to be in his dreams, it was in those, but he was not. No Balsamon. Just ordinary nightmares. He was aware of the wolves, though, when he was awake. They kept their distance from the camps and from the caravan on the move, but he always knew where they were. He could feel their contempt for the dogs guarding the Tuathuan. Noisy beasts who had forgotten what their jaws were for had forgotten the taste of warm blood. They might frighten humans, but they would slink away on their bellies if the pack ever came. Each day his awareness was sharper, more clear. Dapple grew more impatient with every sunset. That Elias wanted to do this thing of taking the humans south made it worth doing. But if it must be done, then let it be done. Let this slow travel end. Wolves were meant to roam, and she did not like being away from the pack so long. Impatience burned in wind, too. Hunting was worse than poor here, and he despised living on field mice, something for cubs to stalk while learning to hunt. Fit food for the old, no longer able to pull down a deer or hamstring a wild ox. Sometimes Wynne thought that Byrne had been right, leave human troubles to humans. But he was wary of such thoughts when Dapple was around, and even more so around Hopper. Hopper was a scarred and grizzled fighter, impassive with the knowledge of years, with guile that more than made up for anything of which age might have robbed him. For humans he cared nothing, but Dapple wished this thing done, and Hopper would wait as she waited, and run as she ran. Wolf or man, bull or bear, whatever challenged Dapple would find Hopper's jaws waiting to send them to the long sleep. That was the whole of life for Hopper, and that kept Wind cautious, and Dapple seemed to ignore the thoughts of both. All of it was clear in Perrin's mind. Fervently he wished for Camelin, for Moraine and Tarvalin. Even if there were no answers, there could be an end to it. Elias looked at him, and he was sure the yellow-eyed man knew. Please let there be an end. The dream began more pleasantly than most he had of late. He was at Osbeth Luhan's kitchen table, sharpening his axe with a stone. Mistress Luhan never allowed forge work or anything that smacked of it to be brought into the house. Master Luhan even had to take her knives outside to sharpen them. But she tended her cooking and never said a word about the axe. She did not even say anything when a wolf entered from deeper in the house and curled up between Perrin and the door to the yard. Perrin went on sharpening. It would be time to use it soon. Abruptly, the wolf rose, rumbling deep in its throat, the thick ruff of fur on its neck rising. Baalzamon stepped into the kitchen from the yard. Mistress Luhan went on with her cooking. Perrin scrambled to his feet, raising the axe, but Baalzamon ignored the weapon, concentrating on the wolf instead. Flames danced where his eyes should be.
"Is this what you have to protect you?"
"Well, I have faced this before. Many times before."
He crooked a finger, and the wolf howled as fire burst out of its eyes and ears and mouth, out of its skin. The stench of burning meat and hair filled the kitchen. Osbert Luhan lifted the lid on a pot and stirred with a wooden spoon. Perrin dropped the axe and jumped forward, trying to beat out the flames with his hands. The wolf crumpled to black ash between his palms. Staring at the shapeless pile of char on Mistress Luhan's clean-swept floor, he backed away. He wished he could wipe the greasy soot from his hands, but the thought of scrubbing it off on his clothes turned his stomach. He snatched up the axe, gripping the haft until his knuckles cracked.
"Leave me alone!"
he shouted. Mistress Luhan tapped the spoon on the rim of the pot and replaced the lid, humming to herself.
"You cannot run from me," Baalzamon said. "You cannot hide from me. If you are the one, you are mine."
The heat from the fires of his face forced Perrin across the kitchen until his back came up against the wall. Mistress Luhan opened the oven to check her bread.
"The eye of the world will consume you," Baalzamon said. "I mark you mine."
He flung out his clenched hand as if throwing something. When his fingers opened, a raven streaked at Perrin's face. Perrin screamed as the black beak pierced his left eye, and sat up, clutching his face, surrounded by the sleeping wagons of the traveling people. Slowly he lowered his hands. There was no pain, no blood. But he could remember it, remember the stabbing agony. He shuddered, and suddenly Elias was squatting beside him in the pre-dawn, one hand outstretched as if to shake him awake. Beyond the trees where the wagons lay, the wolves howled, one sharp cry from three throats. He shared their sensations. Fire, pain, fire, hate, hate, kill.
"Yes," Elias said softly. "It is time. Get up, boy. It's time for us to go."
Perrin scrambled out of his blankets. While he was still bundling his blanket roll, rain came out of his wagon, rubbing sleep from his eyes. The seeker glanced at the sky and froze halfway down the steps, his hands still raised to his face. Only his eyes moved as he studied the sky intently, though Perrin could not understand what he was looking at. A few clouds hung in the east, undersides streaked with pink from the sun yet to rise, but there was nothing else to see. Rain seemed to listen as well, and smell the air, but there was no sound except the wind in the trees, and no smell but the faint, smoky remnant of last night's campfires. Elias returned with his own scanty belongings, and rain came the rest of the way down.
"We must change the direction we travel, my old friend."
The seeker looked uneasily at the sky again.
"We go another way this day. Will you be coming with us?"
Elias shook his head, and Rain nodded as if he had known all along.
"Well, take care, my old friend. There is something about today."
He started to look up once more, but pulled his eyes back down before they rose above the wagon tops.
"I think the wagons will go east, perhaps all the way to the spine of the world. Perhaps we'll find a steading and stay there a while."
"Trouble never enters the steading," Elias agreed, "but the Ogier are none too open to strangers."
"Everyone is open to the traveling people," Rain said, and grinned. "Besides, even Ogier have pots and things to mend. Come, let us have some breakfast and we'll talk about it."
"No time," Elias said. "We move on today, too, as soon as possible.
It's a day for moving, it seems. Rain tried to convince him to at least stay long enough for food, and when Ila appeared from the wagon with Egwene, she added her arguments, though not as strenuously as her husband. She said all of the right words, but her politeness was stiff, and it was plain she would be glad to see Elias's back, if not Egwene's. Egwene did not notice the regretful, sidelong looks Ila gave her. She asked what was going on, and Perrin prepared himself for her to say she wanted to stay with the Tuathoan, but when Elias explained, she only nodded thoughtfully and hurried back into the wagon to gather her things. Finally, Rain threw up his hands.
All right. I don't know that I have ever let a visitor leave this camp without a farewell feast, but...
Uncertainly, his eyes raised toward the sky again.
Well, we need an early start ourselves, I think. Perhaps we will eat as we journey. But at least let everyone say goodbye.
Elias started to protest, but Rain was already hurrying from wagon to wagon, pounding on the doors, where there was no one awake. By the time a tinker came, leading Bella, the whole camp had turned out in their finest and brightest, a mass of color that made Rain and Ila's red and yellow wagon seem almost plain. The big dogs strolled through the crowd with their tongues lolling out of their mouths, looking for someone to scratch their ears, while Perrin and the others endured handshake after handshake and hug after hug. The girls who had danced every night would not be content with shaking hands, and their hugs made Perrin suddenly wish he was not leaving after all, until he remembered how many others were watching, and then his face almost matched the Seeker's wagon. Aram drew Egwene a little aside. Perrin could not hear what he had to say to her over the noise of goodbyes, but she kept shaking her head, slowly at first, then more firmly as he began to gesture pleadingly. His face shifted from pleading to arguing, but she continued to shake her head stubbornly until Ila rescued her with a few sharp words to her grandson. Scowling, Aram pushed away through the crowd, abandoning the rest of the farewell. Ila watched him go, hesitating on the point of calling him back. She's relieved, too, Perrin thought. Relieved he doesn't want to go with us, with Egwene. When he had shaken every hand in the camp at least once and hugged every girl at least twice, the crowd moved back, opening a little space around Rain and Ila and the three visitors.
"You came in peace," Rain intoned, bowing formally, hands on his chest.
"Depart now in peace. Always will our fires welcome you in peace. The way of the leaf is peace."
"Peace be on you always," Elias replied, "and on all the people." He hesitated, then added, "I will find the song, or another will find the song, but the song will be sung this year or in a year to come. As it once was, so shall it be again, world without end." Rain blinked in surprise, and Ila looked completely flabbergasted, but all the other Tuathoan murmured in reply, "World without end, world and time without end." Rain and his wife hurriedly said the same after everyone else. Then it really was time to go. A few last farewells, a few last admonitions to take care, a few last smiles and winks, and they were making their way out of the camp. Rain accompanied them as far as the edge of the trees, a pair of the dogs cavorting by his side.
"Truly, my old friend, you must take care. This day, there is wickedness loose in the world, I fear, and whatever you pretend, you are not so wicked that it will not gobble you up."
"Peace be on you," Elias said.
"And on you,"
Rain said sadly. When Rain was gone, Elias scowled at finding the other two looking at him. "So I don't believe in their fool song," he growled. "No need to make them feel bad by messing up their ceremony, was there? I told you they set a store by ceremony sometimes."
"Of course," Egwene said gently. "No need at all."
Elias turned away, muttering to himself. Dapple, Wind, and Hopper came to greet Elias, not frolicking as the dogs had done, but a dignified meeting of equals. Perrin caught what passed between them.
"Fire Eyes, Pain, Heart Fang, Death, Heart Fang."
Perrin knew what they meant. The Dark One. They were telling about his dream. Their dream. He shivered as the wolves ranged out ahead, scouting the way. It was Egwene's turn to ride Bella, and he walked beside her. Elias led, as usual, a steady, ground-eating pace. Perrin did not want to think about his dream. He had thought that the wolves made them safe.
not complete, except full heart, full mind. You will struggle, only complete when you accept.
He forced the wolves out of his head and blinked in surprise. He had not known he could do that. He determined not to let them back in again.
Even in dreams?
He was not sure if the thought was his or theirs. Egwene still wore the string of blue beads Aram had given her, and a little sprig of something with tiny, bright red leaves in her hair, another gift from the young Tuathuan. That Aram had tried to talk her into staying with the traveling people, Perrin was sure. He was glad she had not given in, but he wished she did not finger the beads so fondly. Finally, he said, "What did you spend so much time talking about with Ila? If you weren't dancing with that long-legged fellow, you were talking to her like it was some kind of secret."
"Ila was giving me advice on being a woman," Egwene replied absently.
He began laughing, and she gave him a hooded, dangerous look that he failed to see.
"Advice? Nobody tells us how to be men. We just are."
"That," Egwene said, "is probably why you make such a bad job of it."
Up ahead, Elias cackled loudly.
Chapter 28 Footprints in Air. Nynaeve stared in wonder at what lay ahead down the river, the white bridge gleaming in the sun with a milky glow. Another legend, she thought, glancing at the warder and the Aes Sedai riding just ahead of her. Another legend, and they don't even seem to notice. She resolved not to stare where they could see. They'll laugh if they see me gaping like a country bumpkin. The three rode on silently toward the fabled white bridge. Since that morning after Shadar Logoth, when she had found Moiraine and Lan on the bank of the Arenel, there had been little in the way of real conversation between her and the Aes Sedai. There had been talk, of course, but nothing of substance as Nynaeve saw it. Moiraine's attempts to talk her into going to Tar Valon, for instance. Tar Valon. She would go there if need be and take their training, but not for the reasons the Aes Sedai thought. If Moiraine had brought harm to Egwene and the boys... Sometimes, against her will, Nynaeve had found herself thinking of what a wisdom could do with the one power, of what she could do. Whenever she realized what was in her head, though, a flash of anger burned it out. The power was a filthy thing. She would have nothing to do with it, unless she had to. The cursed woman only wanted to talk about taking her to Tar Valon for training. Moiraine would not tell her anything. It was not as if she wanted to know so much. "How do you mean to find them?" she remembered demanding. "As I have told you," Moiraine replied, without bothering to look back at her. "I will know when I am close to the two who have lost their coins." It was not the first time Nynaeve had asked, but the Aes Sedai's voice was like a still pond that refused to ripple, no matter how many stones Nynaeve threw. It made the wisdom's blood boil every time she was exposed to it. Moiraine went on as if she could not feel Nynaeve's eyes on her back. Nynaeve knew she must be able to, she was staring so hard. "The longer it takes, the closer I must come, but I will know. As for the one who still has his token, so long as he has it in his possession, I can follow him across half the world if need be." "And then? What do you plan when you've found them, Aes Sedai?" She did not for a minute believe the Aes Sedai would be so intent on finding them if she did not have plans. "Tar Valon, wisdom. Tar Valon. Tar Valon. That's all you ever say, and I am becoming..." "Part of the training you will receive in Tar Valon, wisdom, will teach you to control your temper. You can do nothing with the one power when emotion rules your mind." Nynaeve opened her mouth, but the Aes Sedai went right on. "Lan, I must speak with you a moment." The two put their heads together, and Nynaeve was left with a sullen glower that she hated every time she realized it was on her face. It came too often as the Aes Sedai deftly turned her questions off onto another subject, slid easily by her conversational traps, or ignored her shouts until they ended in silence. The scowl made her feel like a girl who had been caught acting the fool by someone in the women's circle. That was a feeling Nynaeve was not used to, and the calm smile on Moiraine's face only made it worse. If only there was some way to get rid of the woman. Lan would be better by himself. A warder should be able to handle what was needed, she told herself hastily, feeling a sudden flush. No other reason, but one meant the other. And yet, Lan made her even more furious than Moiraine. She could not understand how he managed to get under her skin so easily. He rarely said anything, sometimes not a dozen words in a day, and he never took part in any of the discussions with Moiraine. He was often apart from the two women scouting the land, but even when he was there he kept a little to one side, watching them as if watching a duel. Nynaeve wished he would stop. If it was a duel she had not managed to score once, and Moiraine did not even seem to realize she was in a fight. Nynaeve could have done without his cool blue eyes, without even a silent audience. That had been the way of their journey for the most part. Quiet, except when her temper got the best of her, and sometimes when she shouted, the sound of her voice seemed to crash in the silence like breaking glass. The land itself was quiet, as if the world were pausing to catch its breath. The wind moaned in the trees, but all else was still. The wind seemed distant, too, even when it was cutting through the cloak on her back. At first the silence was restful after everything that had happened. It seemed as if she had not known a moment of quiet since before winter night. By the end of the first day alone with the Aes Sedai and the warder, though, she was looking over her shoulder and fidgeting in her saddle as if she had an itch in the middle of her back where she could not reach. The silence seemed like crystal doomed to shatter, and waiting for the first crack put her teeth on edge. It weighed on Moiraine and Lan, too, as outwardly unperturbable as they were. She soon realized that, beneath their calm surfaces, hour by hour they wound tighter and tighter, like clock springs being forced to the breaking point. Moiraine seemed to listen to things that were not there, and what she heard put a crease in her forehead. Lan watched the forest and the river as if the leafless trees and wide, slow water carried the signs of traps and ambushes waiting ahead. Part of her was glad that she was not the only one who apprehended that poised-on-the-brink feel to the world, but if it affected them, it was real, and another part of her wanted nothing so much as for it to be just her imagination. Something of it tickled the corners of her mind, as when she listened to the wind, but now she knew that that had to do with the one power, and she could not bring herself to embrace those ripples at the edge of thought. "It is nothing," Lan said quietly when she asked. He did not look at her while he spoke. His eyes never ceased their scanning. Then, contradicting what he had just said, he added, "You should go back to your two rivers when we reach Whitebridge and the Camelin Road. It's too dangerous here. Nothing will try to stop you going back, though." It was the longest speech he had made all that day. "She is part of the pattern, Lan," Moiraine said chidingly. Her gaze was elsewhere, too. "It is the Dark One, Nynaeve. The storm has left us, for a time at least." She raised one hand as though feeling the air, then scrubbed it on her dress unconsciously as if she had touched filth. "He is still watching, however," she sighed, "and his gaze is stronger. Not on us, but on the world. How much longer before he is strong enough to..." Nynaeve hunched her shoulders. Suddenly she could almost feel someone staring at her back. It was one explanation she would just as soon the Aes Sedai had not given her. Lan scouted their path down the river, but where before he had chosen the way, now Moiraine did so, as surely as if she followed some unseen track, footprints in air, the scent of memory. Lan only checked the route she intended to see that it was safe. Nynaeve had the feeling that even if he said it was not, Moiraine would insist on it anyway. And he would go, she was sure, straight down the river to... With a start, Nynaeve pulled out of her thoughts. They were at the foot of the White Bridge. The pale arch shone in the sunlight, a milky spider web too delicate to stand, sweeping across the Arenal. The weight of a man would bring it crashing down, much less that of a horse. Surely it would collapse under its own weight any minute. Lan and Moiraine rode unconcernedly ahead, up the gleaming white approach and onto the bridge, hooves ringing, not like steel on glass, but like steel on steel. The surface of the bridge certainly looked as slick as glass, wet glass, but it gave the horses a firm, sure footing. Nynaeve made herself follow, but from the first step she half waited for the entire structure to shatter under them. If lace were made of glass, she thought, it would look like this. It was not until they were almost all the way across that she noted the tarry smell of char thickening the air. In a moment she saw. Around the square at the foot of the white bridge, piles of blackened timbers, still leaking smoky threads, replaced half a dozen buildings. Men in poorly fitting red uniforms and tarnished armor patrolled the streets, but they marched quickly, as if afraid of finding anything, and they looked over their shoulders as they went. Townspeople, the few who were out, almost ran, shoulders hunched, as though something were chasing them. Lan looked grim, even for him, and people walked wide of the three of them, even the soldiers. The warder sniffed the air and grimaced, growling under his breath. It was no wonder to Nynaeve, with the stink of burn so strong. "The wheel weaves as the wheel wills," Moiraine mumbled. "No eye can see the pattern until it is woven." In the next moment she was down off Aldeeb and speaking to townsfolk. She did not ask questions, she gave sympathy, and to Nynaeve's surprise it appeared genuine. People who shied away from Lan, ready to hurry from any stranger, stopped to speak with Moiraine. They appeared startled themselves at what they were doing, but they opened up after a fashion, under Moiraine's clear gaze and soothing voice. The Aes Sedai's eyes seemed to share the people's hurt, to empathize with their confusion, and tongues loosened. They still lied, though, most of them. Some denied there had been any trouble at all. Nothing at all. Moiraine mentioned the burned buildings all around the square. Everything was fine, they insisted, staring past what they did not want to see. One fat fellow spoke with a hollow heartiness, but his cheek twitched at every noise behind him. With a grin that kept slipping, he claimed an overturned lamp had started a fire that spread with the wind before anything could be done. One glance showed Nynaeve that no burned structure stood alongside another. There were almost as many different stories as there were people. Several women lowered their voices conspiratorially. The truth of the matter was there was a man somewhere in the town meddling with the One Power. It was time to have the Aes Sedai in. Past time was the way they saw it, no matter what the men said about Tar Valon. Let the Red Aja settle matters. One man claimed it had been an attack by bandits, and another said a riot by Dark Friends. "Those ones going to see the false dragon, you know," he confided darkly. "They're all over the place. Dark Friends, everyone." Still others spoke of some kind of trouble. They were vague about exactly what kind, that had come downriver on a boat. "We showed them," a narrow-faced man muttered, scrubbing his hands together nervously. "Let them keep that kind of thing in the borderlands where it belongs. We went down to the docks and—" He cut off so abruptly his teeth clicked. Without another word, he scurried off, peering back over his shoulder at them as if he thought they might chase him down. The boat had gotten away. That much was clear eventually from others, cutting its moorings and fleeing downriver only the day before while a mob poured onto the docks. Nynaeve wondered if Egwene and the boys had been on board. One woman said that a glee man had been on the boat. If that had been Tom Merrillin. She tried her opinion on Moiraine, that some of the Emmons Fielders might have fled on the boat. The Aes Sedai listened patiently, nodding until she was done. "Perhaps," Moiraine said then, but she sounded doubtful. An inn still stood in the square, the common room divided in two by a shoulder-high wall. Moiraine paused as she stepped into the inn, feeling the air with her hand. She smiled at whatever it was she felt, but she would say nothing of it then. Their meal was consumed in silence, silence not only at their table but throughout the common room. The handful of people eating there concentrated on their own plates and their own thoughts. The innkeeper, dusting tables with a corner of his apron, muttered to himself continually, but always too low to be heard. Nynaeve thought it would not be pleasant sleeping there, Even the air was heavy with fear. About the time they pushed their plates away, wiped clean with the last scraps of bread, one of the red-uniformed soldiers appeared in the doorway. He seemed resplendent to Nynaeve in his peaked helmet and burnished breastplate until he took a pose just inside the door with a hand resting on the hilt of his sword and a stern look on his face and used a finger to ease his too-tight collar. It made her think of Sen Bui trying to act the way a village councillor should. Lan spared him one glance and snorted, "Militia. Useless." The soldier looked over the room, letting his eyes come to rest on them. He hesitated, then took a deep breath before stomping over to demand, all in a rush, who they were, what their business was in Whitebridge, and how long they intended to stay. "We are leaving as soon as I finish my ale," Lan said. He took another slow swallow before looking up at the soldier. "The light illumine good Queen Morgay's." The red-uniformed man opened his mouth, then took a good look at Lan's eyes and stepped back. He caught himself immediately with a glance at Moiraine and her. She thought for a moment that he was going to do something foolish to keep from looking the coward in front of two women. In her experience, men were often idiots that way. But too much had happened in Whitebridge. Too much uncertainty had escaped from the cellars of men's minds. The militiaman looked back at Lan and reconsidered once more. The warder's hard-planed face was expressionless, but there were those cold blue eyes. So cold. The militiaman settled on a brisk nod. "See that you do. Too many strangers around these days for the good of the Queen's peace." Turning on his heel, he stomped out again, practicing his stern look on the way. None of the locals in the inn seemed to notice. "Where are we going?" Nynaeve demanded of the warder. The mood in the room was such that she kept her voice low, but she made sure it was firm, too. "After the boat?" Lan looked at Moiraine, who shook her head slightly, and said, "First I must find the one I can be sure of finding, and at present he is somewhere to the north of us. I do not think the other two went with the boat in any case." A small, satisfied smile touched her lips. "They were in this room, perhaps a day ago, no more than two. Afraid, but they left alive. The trace would not have lasted without that strong emotion." "Which two?" Nynaeve leaned over the table intently. "Do you know?" The Aes Sedai shook her head, the slightest of motions, and Nynaeve settled back. "If they're only a day or two ahead, why don't we go after them first?" "I know they were here," Moiraine said in that insufferably calm voice. "But beyond that I cannot say if they went east or north or south. I trust they are smart enough to have gone east, toward Camelin, but I do not know, and lacking their tokens I will not know where they are until I am perhaps within half a mile. In 2 days they could have gone 20 miles, or 40, in any direction, if fear urged them, and they were certainly afraid when they left here. But wisdom. However fearful they were, in whatever direction they ran, eventually they will remember Camelin, and it is there I will find them. But I will help the one I can find now, first." Nynaeve opened her mouth again, but Lan cut her off in a soft voice. "They had reason to be afraid." He looked around, then lowered his voice. "There was a halfman here." He grimaced the way he had in the square. "I can still smell him everywhere." Moiraine sighed. "I will keep hope until I know it is gone. I refuse to believe the Dark One can win so easily. I will find all three of them alive and well. I must believe it." "I want to find the boys, too," Nynaeve said. "But what about Egwene? You never even mention her, and you ignore me when I ask. I thought you were going to take her off to..." She glanced at the other tables and lowered her voice. "To Tar Valon." The Aes Sedai studied the tabletop for a moment before raising her eyes to Nynaeve's, and when she did, Nynaeve started back from a flash of anger that seemed almost to make Moiraine's eyes glow. Then her back stiffened, her own anger rising, but before she could say a word, the Aes Sedai spoke coldly. "I hope to find Egwene alive and well, too. I do not easily give up young women with that much ability once I have found them, but it will be as the wheel weaves. Nynaeve felt a cold ball in the pit of her stomach. Am I one of those young women you won't give up? We'll see about that, Aes Sedai. The light burn you, we'll see about that. The meal was finished in silence, and it was a silent three who rode through the gates and down the Camelin Road. Moiraine's eyes searched the horizon to the northeast. Behind them, the smoke-stained town of Whitebridge cowered.
Chapter 29 Eyes Without Pity. Elias pushed for speed across the brown grass flatland, as if trying to make up for the time spent with the traveling people, setting a pace southward that had even Bella grateful to stop when twilight deepened. Despite his desire for haste, though, he took precautions he had not taken before. At night they had a fire only if there was dead wood already on the ground. He would not let them break so much as a twig off of a standing tree. The fires he made were small and always hidden in a pit carefully dug, where he had cut away a plug of sod. As soon as their meal was prepared, he buried the coals and replaced the plug. Before they set out again in the gray false dawn, he went over the campsite inch by inch to make sure there was no sign that anyone had ever been there. He even righted overturned rocks and straightened bent-down weeds. He did it quickly, never taking more than a few minutes, but they did not leave until he was satisfied. Per did not think the precautions were much good against dreams, but when he began to think of what they might be good against, he wished it were only the dreams. The first time, Egwene asked anxiously if the Trollocs were back, but Elias only shook his head and urged them on. Perrin said nothing. He knew there were no Trollocs close. The wolves scented only grass and trees and small animals. It was not fear of Trollocs that drove Elias, but something else, of which even Elias was not sure. The wolves knew nothing of what it was, but they sensed Elias's urgent wariness, and they began to scout as if danger ran at their heels or waited in ambush over the next rise. The land became long, rolling crests, too low to be called hills, rising across their path. A carpet of tough grass, still winter sere, and dotted with rank weeds spread before them, rippled by an east wind that had nothing to cut it for 100 miles. The groves of trees grew more scattered. The sun rose reluctantly, without warmth. Among the squat ridges, Elias followed the contours of the land as much as possible, and he avoided topping the rises whenever possible. He seldom talked, and when he did... "You know how long this is taking, going around every bloody little hill like this? Blood and ashes! I'll be till summer getting you off my hands. Now we can't just go in a straight line. How many times do I have to tell you? You have any idea, even the faintest, how a man stands out on a ridgeline in country like this? Burn me, but we're going back and forth as much as forward, wiggling like a snake. I could move faster with my feet tied." Were you going to stare at me, or are you going to walk? Perrin exchanged glances with Egwene. She stuck her tongue out at Elias's back. Neither of them said anything. The one time Egwene had protested that Elias was the one who wanted to go around the hills, and he should not blame them, it got her a lecture on how sound carried, delivered in a growl that could have been heard a mile off. He gave the lecture over his shoulder, and he never even slowed to give it. Whether he was talking or not, Elias's eyes searched all around them, sometimes staring as if there were something to see except the same coarse grass that was under their feet. If he did see anything, Perrin could not, and neither could the wolves. Elias's forehead grew extra furrows, but he would not explain. Not why they had to hurry, not what he was afraid was hunting them. Sometimes a longer ridge than usual lay across their path, stretching miles and miles to east and west. Even Elias had to agree that going around those would take them too far out of their way. He did not let them simply cross over, though. Leaving them at the base of the slope, he would creep up to the crest on his belly, peering over as cautiously as though the wolves had not scouted there 10 minutes before. Waiting at the bottom of the ridge, minutes passed like hours, and the not knowing pressed on them. Egwene chewed her lip and unconsciously clicked the beads Aram had given her through her fingers. Perrin waited doggedly. His stomach twisted up in a sick knot, but he managed to keep his face calm, managed to keep the turmoil hidden inside. The wolves will warn if there's danger. It would be wonderful if they went away, if they just vanished, but right now they'll give warning. What is he looking for?
What?
After a long search, with only his eyes above the rise, Elias always motioned them to come ahead. Every time the way ahead was clear, until the next time they found a ridge they could not go around. At the third such ridge, Perrin's stomach lurched. Sour fumes rose in his throat, and he knew if he had to wait even 5 minutes, he would vomit. He swallowed.
I'm coming, too.
Keep low, was all Elias said. As soon as he spoke, Egwene jumped down from Bella. The fur-clad man pushed his round hat forward and peered at her from under the edge.
You expecting to make that mare crawl? He said dryly.
Her mouth worked, but no sound came out. Finally she shrugged, and Elias turned away without another word and began climbing the easy slope. Perrin hurried after him. Well short of the crest, Elias made a downward motion, and a moment later flattened himself on the ground, wriggling forward the last few yards. Perrin flopped on his belly. At the top, Elias took off his hat before raising his head ever so slowly. Peering through a clump of thorny weeds, Perrin saw only the same rolling plain that lay behind them. The downslope was bare, though a clump of trees 100 paces across grew in the hollow, perhaps half a mile south from the ridge. The wolves had already been through it, smelling no trace of Trollocs or Murdral. East and west, the land was the same as far as Perrin could see, rolling grassland and wide scattered thickets. Nothing moved. The wolves were more than a mile ahead, out of sight. At that distance, he could barely feel them. They had seen nothing when they covered this ground.
What is he looking for? There's nothing there.
We're wasting time, he said, starting to stand, and a flock of ravens burst out of the trees below, 50, 100 black birds spiraling into the sky. He froze in a crouch as they milled over the trees.
The Dark One's eyes. Did they see me?
Sweat trickled down his face. As if one thought had suddenly sparked in 100 tiny minds, every raven broke sharply in the same direction. South. The flock disappeared over the next rise, already descending. To the east, another thicket disgorged more ravens. The black mass wheeled twice and headed south. Shaking, he lowered himself to the ground slowly. He tried to speak, but his mouth was too dry. After a minute, he managed to work up some spit.
Was that what you were afraid of? Why didn't you say something? Why didn't the wolves see them?
Wolves don't look up in trees much, Elias growled. And no, I wasn't looking for this. I told you I didn't know what.
Far to the west, a black cloud rose over yet another grove and winged southward. They were too far off to make out individual birds.
It isn't a big hunt, thank the light. They don't know. Even after.
He turned to stare back the way they had come. Perrin swallowed. Even after the dream, Elias had meant.
Not big, he said. Back home you won't see that many ravens in a whole year.
Elias shook his head.
In the borderlands I've seen sweeps with 1,000 ravens to the flock. Not too often. There's still a bounty on ravens there, but it has happened.
He was still looking north.
Hush now.
Perrin felt it then, the effort of reaching out to the distant wolves. Elias wanted Dapple and her companions to quit scouting ahead, to hurry back and check their back trail. His already gaunt face tightened and thinned under the strain. The wolves were so far away, Perrin could not even feel them.
Hurry, watch the sky. Hurry.
Faintly, Perrin caught the reply from far to the south.
We come.
An image flashed in his mind. Wolves running, muzzles pointing into the wind of their haste, running as if wildfire raced behind. Running. Flashed and was gone in an instant. Elias slumped and drew a deep breath. Frowning, he peered over the ridge, then back to the north and muttered under his breath.
You think there are more ravens behind us? Perrin asked.
Could be, Elias said vaguely. They do it that way sometimes. I know a place, if we can reach it by dark. We have to keep moving until full dark anyway, even if we don't get there. But we can't go as fast as I would like. Can't afford to get too close to the ravens ahead of us. But if they're behind us, too.
Why dark?
Perrin said.
What place?
Somewhere safe from the ravens? Safe from ravens, Elias said. But too many people know.
Raven's roost for the night. We don't have to worry about them finding us in the dark. The lights and ravens are all we have to worry about then. With one more look over the crest, he rose and waved to Egwene to bring Bella up. But dark is a long way off. We have to get moving. He started down the far slope in a shambling run, each stride barely catching him on the edge of falling.
Move, burn you!
Perrin moved, half running, half sliding after him. Egwene topped the rise behind them, kicking Bella to a trot. A grin of relief bloomed on her face when she saw them. What's going on? She called, urging the shaggy mare to catch up. When you disappeared like that, I thought... What happened? Perrin saved his breath for running until she reached them. He explained about the ravens and Elias's safe place, but it was a disjointed story. After a strangled,
Ravens!
She kept interrupting with questions for which, as often as not, he had no answers. Between them, he did not finish until they reached the next ridge. Ordinarily, if anything about the journey could be called ordinary, they would have gone around this one rather than over, but Elias insisted on scouting anyway. You want to just saunter right into the middle of them, boy? Was his sour comment. Egwene stared at the crest of the ridge, licking her lips, as if she wanted to go with Elias this time, and wanted to stay where she was, too. Elias was the only one who showed no hesitation. Perrin wondered if the ravens ever doubled back. It would be a fine thing to reach the crest at the same time as a flock of ravens. At the top, he inched his head up until he could just see, and heaved a sigh of relief when all he saw was a copse of trees a little to the west. There were no ravens to be seen. Abruptly, a fox burst out of the trees, running hard. Ravens poured from the branches after it. The beat of their wings almost drowned out a desperate whining from the fox. A black whirlwind dove and swirled around it. The fox's jaws snapped at them, but they darted in and darted away untouched, black beaks glistening wetly. The fox turned back toward the trees, seeking the safety of its den. It ran awkwardly now, head low, fur dark and bloody, and the ravens flapped around it, more and more of them at once, the fluttering mass thickening until it hid the fox completely. As suddenly as they had descended, the ravens rose, wheeled, and vanished over the next rise to the south. A misshapen lump of torn fur marked what had been the fox. Perrin swallowed hard.
Light. They could do that to us. 100 ravens. They could...
Move,
Elias growled, jumping up. He waved to Egwene to come on, and without waiting, set off at a trot toward the trees.
Move, burn you, he called over his shoulder. Move!
Egwene galloped Bella over the rise and caught them before they reached the bottom of the slope. There was no time for explanations, but her eyes picked out the fox right away. Her face went as white as snow. Elias reached the trees and turned there, at the edge of the copse, waving vigorously for them to hurry. Perrin tried to run faster and stumbled. Arms windmilling, he barely caught himself short of going flat on his face.
Blood and ashes, I'm running as fast as I can.
A lone raven winged out of the copse. It tilted toward them, screamed, and spun toward the south. Knowing he was already too late, Perrin fumbled his sling from around his waist. He was still trying to get a stone from his pocket to the sling when the raven abruptly folded up in midair and plummeted to the ground. His mouth dropped open, and then he saw the sling hanging from Egwene's hand. She grinned at him unsteadily.
"Don't stand there counting your toes," Elias called.
With a start, Perrin hurried into the trees, then jumped out of the way to avoid being trampled by Egwene and Bella. Far to the west, almost out of sight, what seemed like a dark mist rose into the air. Perrin felt the wolves passing in that direction, heading north. He felt them notice ravens to the left and right of them, without slowing. The dark mist swirled northward as if pursuing the wolves, then abruptly broke off and flashed to the south.
"Do you think they saw us?" Egwene asked. "We were already in the trees, weren't we? They couldn't see us at that distance, could they? Not that far off."
"We saw them at that distance," Elias said dryly.
Perrin shifted uneasily, and Egwene drew a frightened breath.
"If they had seen us," Elias growled, "they'd have been down on us like they were on that fox. Think if you want to stay alive. Fear will kill you if you don't control it."
His penetrating stare held on each of them for a moment. Finally, he nodded.
They're gone now, and we should be too. Keep those slings handy. Might be useful again.
As they moved out of the copse, Elias angled them westward from the line of march they had been following. Perrin's breath snagged in his throat. It was as if they were chasing after the last ravens they had seen. Elias kept on tirelessly, and there was nothing for them to do but follow. After all, Elias knew a safe place. Somewhere, so he said. They ran to the next hill, waited till the ravens moved on, then ran again, waited, ran. The steady progress they had been keeping had been tiring enough, but all except Elias quickly began to flag under this jerky pace. Perrin's chest heaved, and he gulped air when he had a few minutes to lie on a hilltop, leaving the search to Elias. Bella stood head down, nostrils flaring at every stop. Fear lashed them on, and Perrin did not know if it was controlled or not. He only wished the wolves would tell them what was behind them, if anything was, whatever it was. Ahead there were more ravens than Perrin ever hoped to see again. To the left and right, the blackbirds billowed up, and to the south. A dozen times they reached the hiding place of a grove or the scant shelter of a slope only moments before ravens swept into the sky. Once, with the sun beginning to slide from its midday height, they stood in the open, frozen, as still as statues, half a mile from the nearest cover, while 100 of the Dark One's feathered spies flashed by a bare mile to the east. Sweat rolled down Perrin's face despite the wind, until the last black shape dwindled to a dot and vanished. He lost count of the stragglers they brought down with their slings. He saw more than enough evidence lying in the path the ravens had covered to justify his fear. He had stared with a queasy fascination at a rabbit that had been torn to pieces. The eyeless head stood upright, with the other bits, legs, entrails, scattered in a rough circle around it. Birds, too, stabbed to shapeless masses of feathers, and two more foxes. He remembered something Lan had said. All the Dark One's creatures delight in killing. The Dark One's power is death. And if the ravens found them? Pitiless eyes shining like black beads, stabbing beaks swirling around them. Needle-sharp beaks drawing blood. 100 of them. Or can they call more of their kind? Maybe all of them in the hunt. A sickening image built up in his mind. A pile of ravens, as big as a hill, seething like maggots, fighting over a few bloody shreds. Suddenly the image was swept away by others, each one clear for an instant, then spinning and fading into another. The wolves had found ravens to the north. Screaming birds dove and whirled and dove again, beaks drawing blood with every swoop. Snarling wolves dodged and leaped, twisting in the air, jaws snapping. Again and again, Perrin tasted feathers and the foul taste of fluttering ravens crushed alive, felt the pain of oozing gashes all over his body, knew with a despair that never touched on giving up that all his effort was not enough. Suddenly the ravens broke away, wheeling overhead for one last shriek of rage at the wolves. Wolves did not die as easily as foxes, and they had a mission. A flap of black wings, and they were gone, a few black feathers drifting down on their dead. Wind licked at a puncture on his left foreleg. There was something wrong with one of Hopper's eyes. Ignoring her own hurts, Dapple gathered them, and they settled into a painful lope in the direction the ravens had gone. Blood matted their fur. We come. Danger comes before us. Moving in a stumbling trot, Perrin exchanged a glance with Elias. The man's yellow eyes were expressionless, but he knew. He said nothing, just watched Perrin and waited, all the while maintaining that effortless lope. Waiting for me. Waiting for me to admit I feel the wolves. Ravens, Perrin panted reluctantly. Behind us.
He was right, Egwene breathed. You can talk to them.
Perrin's feet felt like lumps of iron on the ends of wooden posts, but he tried to make them move faster. If he could but outrun their eyes, outrun the ravens, outrun the wolves, but above all Egwene's eyes, that knew him now for what he was.
What are you? Tainted? The light blind me. Cursed.
His throat burned, as it never had from breathing the smoke and heat of Master Luhan's forge. He staggered and hung on to Egwene's stirrup until she climbed down and all but pushed him into the saddle despite his protests that he could keep going.
It was not long, though, before she was clutching the stirrup as she ran, holding up her skirts with the other hand, and only a little while after that, until he dismounted, his knees still wobbling. He had to pick her up to make her take his place, but she was too tired to fight him. Elias would not slow down. He urged them and taunted them and kept them so close behind the searching ravens to the south that Perrin thought all it would take would be for one bird to look back.
"Keep moving, burn you! Think you'll do any better than that fox did if they catch us? The one with its insides piled on its head?"
Egwene swayed out of the saddle and vomited noisily.
"I knew you'd remember. Just keep moving a little more. That's all. Just a little more. Burn you, I thought farm youngsters had endurance. Work all day and dance all night. Sleep all day and sleep all night, looks like to me. Move your bloody feet!"
They began coming down off the hills as soon as the last raven vanished over the next one. Then, while the last trailers still flapped above the hilltop. One bird looking back. To east and west the ravens searched while they hurried across the open spaces between them. One bird is all it will take. The ravens behind were coming fast. Dapple and the other wolves worked their way around them, and were coming on without stopping to lick their wounds. But they had learned all the lessons they needed about watching the sky.
How close? How long?
The wolves had no notions of time the way men did, no reasons to divide a day into hours. The seasons were time enough for them, and the light and the dark. No need for more. Finally, Perrin worked out an image of where the sun would stand in the sky when the ravens overran them from behind. He glanced over his shoulder at the setting sun and licked his lips with a dry tongue. In an hour, the ravens would be on them, maybe less. An hour. And it was a good 2 hours to sunset. At least 2 to full dark.
"We'll die with the setting sun," he thought, staggering as he ran, slaughtered like the fox.
He fingered his axe, then moved to his sling. That would be more use. Not enough, though. Not against 100 ravens, 100 darting targets, 100 stabbing beaks.
"It's your turn to ride, Perrin," Egwene said tiredly.
"In a bit," he panted. "I'm good for miles yet."
She nodded and stayed in the saddle.
"She is tired. Tell her, or let her think we still have a chance to escape. An hour of hope, even if it is desperate, or an hour of despair."
Elias was watching him again, saying nothing. He must know, but he did not speak. Perrin looked at Egwene again and blinked away hot tears. He touched his axe and wondered if he had the courage. In the last minutes when the ravens descended on them, when all hope was gone, would he have the courage to spare her the death the fox had died?
"Light make me strong."
The ravens ahead of them suddenly seemed to vanish. Perrin could still make out dark, misty clouds, far to the east and west, but ahead, nothing.
"Where did they go?"
"Light, if we've overrun them."
Abruptly, a chill ran through him, one cold, clean tingle, as if he had jumped into the wine spring water in midwinter. It rippled through him and seemed to carry away some of the fatigue, a little of the ache in his legs and the burning of his lungs.
It left behind something.
He could not say what, only he felt different. He stumbled to a halt and looked around, afraid. Elias watched him, watched them all, with a gleam behind his eyes. He knew what it was, Perrin was sure of it, but he only watched them. Egwene reined in Bella and looked around uncertainly, half wondering and half fearful.
"It's strange," she whispered. "I feel as if I lost something."
Even the mare had her head up expectantly, nostrils flaring as if they detected a faint odor of new-mown hay.
What was that?"
Perrin asked. Elias cackled suddenly. He bent over, shoulders shaking, to rest his hands on his knees.
"Safety, that's what! We made it, you bloody fools! No raven will cross that line. Not one that carries the Dark One's eyes, anyways. A Trolloc would have to be driven across, and there'd need to be something fierce pushing the Murdral to make him do the driving. No Aes Sedai, either. A One Power won't work here. They can't touch the true source. Can't even feel the source, like it vanished. Makes them itch inside, that does.
gives them the shakes like a 7-day drunk.
It's safety.
At first, to Perrin's eyes, the land was unchanged from the rolling hills and ridges they had crossed the whole day. Then he noticed green shoots among the grass. Not many, and they were struggling, but more than he had seen anywhere else. There were fewer weeds in the grass, too. He could not imagine what it was, but there was something about this place. And something in what Elias said tickled his memory.
"What is it?" Egwene asked. "I feel... What is this place? I don't think I like it."
"A studding!" Elias roared. "You never listened to stories? Of course, there hasn't been an Ogier here in 3,000-odd years, not since the breaking of the world. But it's the studding makes the Ogier, not the Ogier makes the studding."
"Just a legend," Perrin stammered. In the stories, the studding were always havens, places to hide, whether it was from Aes Sedai or from creatures of the Father of Lies. Elias straightened. If not exactly fresh, he gave no sign that he had spent most of a day running.
"Come on, we'd better get deeper into this legend. The ravens can't follow, but they can still see us this close to the edge, and there could be enough of them to watch the whole border of it. Let them keep hunting right on by it."
Perrin wanted to stay right there, now that he was stopped. His legs trembled and told him to lie down for a week. Whatever refreshment he had felt had been momentary. All the weariness and aches were back. He forced himself to take one step, then another. It did not get easier, but he kept at it. Egwene flapped the reins to get Bella moving again. Elias settled into an effortless lope, only slowing to a walk when it became apparent the others could not keep up. A fast walk.
"Why don't we stay here?"
Perrin panted. He was breathing through his mouth, and he forced the words out between deep, racking breaths.
"If it's really a steading, we'd be safe. No Trollocs, no Aes Sedai. Why don't we just stay here until it's all over?"
"Maybe the wolves won't come here either."
"How long will that be?"
Elias looked over his shoulder with one eyebrow raised.
"What would you eat? Grass, like the horse? Besides, there's others know about this place, and nothing keeps men out, not even the worst of them. And there is only one place where there's still water to be found."
Frowning uneasily, he turned in a complete circle, scanning the land. When he was done, he shook his head and muttered to himself. Perrin felt him calling to the wolves.
"Hurry, hurry."
"We take our chances on a choice of evils, and the ravens are sure. Come on, it's only another mile or two."
Perrin would have groaned if he had been willing to spare the breath. Huge boulders began to dot the low hills, irregular lumps of gray, lichen-coated stone half buried in the ground, some as big as a house. Brambles webbed them, and low brush half hid most. Here and there, amid the desiccated brown of brambles and brush, a lone green shoot announced that this was a special place. Whatever wounded the land beyond its borders hurt it, too, but here the wound did not go quite as deep. Eventually they straggled over one more rise, and at the base of this hill lay a pool of water. Any of them could have waded across it in two strides, but it was clear and clean enough to show the sandy bottom like a sheet of glass. Even Elias hurried eagerly down the slope. Perrin threw himself full length in the ground when he reached the pool and plunged his head in. An instant later, he was spluttering from the cold of water that had welled up from the depths of the earth. He shook his head, his long hair spraying a rain of drops. Egwene grinned and splashed back at him. Perrin's eyes grew sober. She frowned and opened her mouth, but he stuck his face back in the water.
No questions, not now. No explanations, not ever.
But a small voice taunted him. "But you would have done it, wouldn't you?" Eventually, Elias called him away from the pool.
"Anybody wants to eat? I want some help."
Egwene worked cheerfully, laughing and joking as they prepared their scanty meal. There was nothing left but cheese and dried meat. There had been no chance to hunt. At least there was still tea. Perrin did his share, but silently. He felt Egwene's eyes on him, saw growing worry on her face, but he avoided meeting her eyes as much as he could.
Her laughter faded, and the jokes came further apart, each one more strained than the last. Elias watched, saying nothing. A somber mood descended, and they began their meal in silence. The sun grew red in the west, and their shadows stretched out long and thin. Not quite an hour till dark. If not for the steading, all of you would be dead now. Would you have saved her? Would you have cut her down like so many bushes? Bushes don't bleed, do they? Or scream, and look in your eyes and ask why. Perrin drew in on himself more. He could feel something laughing at him, deep in the back of his mind. Something cruel. Not the Dark One. He almost wished it was. Not the Dark One. Himself. For once Elias had broken his rule about fires. There were no trees, but he snapped dead branches from the brush and built his fire against a huge chunk of rock sticking out of the hillside. From the layers of soot staining the stone, Perrin thought the site must have been used by generation after generation of travelers. What showed above ground of the big rock was rounded somewhat, with a sharp break on one side where moss, old and brown, covered the ragged surface. The grooves and hollows eroded in the rounded part looked odd to Perrin, but he was too absorbed in gloom to wonder about it. Egwene, though, studied it as she ate.
"That," she said finally, "looks like an eye."
Perrin blinked. It did look like an eye, under all that soot.
"It is," Elias said.
He sat with his back to the fire and the rock, studying the land around them while he chewed on a strip of dried meat almost as tough as leather.
"Arthur Hawkwing's eye. The eye of the High King himself. This is what his power and glory came to in the end."
He said it absently. Even his chewing was absent-minded. His eyes and his attention were on the hills.
"Arthur Hawkwing!" Egwene exclaimed. "You're joking with me. It isn't an eye at all. Why would somebody carve Arthur Hawkwing's eye on a rock out here?"
Elias glanced over his shoulder at her, muttering.
"What do they teach you, village whelps?"
He snorted and straightened back to his watching, but he went on talking.
"Arthur Paindrag Tanrial, Arthur Hawkwing, the High King, united all the lands from the Great Blight to the Sea of Storms, from the Arith Ocean to the Aiel Waste, and even some beyond the Waste. He even sent armies the other side of the Arith Ocean. The stories say he ruled the whole world, but what he really did rule was enough for any man outside of a story, and he brought peace and justice to the land."
"All stood equal before the law," Egwene said, "and no man raised his hand against another."
"So you've heard the stories, at least," Elias chuckled, a dry sound. "Arthur Hawkwing brought peace and justice, but he did it with fire and sword. A child could ride alone with a bag of gold from the Arith Ocean to the spine of the world and never have a moment's fear. But the High King's justice was as hard as that rock there for anyone who challenged his power, even if it was just by being who they were, or by people thinking they were a challenge. The common folk had peace and justice and full bellies. But he laid a 20-year siege to Tar Valon, and put a price of 1,000 gold crowns on the head of every Aes Sedai."
"I thought you didn't like Aes Sedai," Egwene said.
Elias gave a wry smile.
"Doesn't matter what I like, girl. Arthur Hawkwing was a proud fool. An Aes Sedai healer could have saved him when he took sick, or was poisoned, as some say. But every Aes Sedai still alive was penned up behind the shining walls, using all their power to hold off an army that lit up the night with their campfires. He wouldn't have let one near him anyway. He hated Aes Sedai as much as he hated the Dark One."
Egwene's mouth tightened, but when she spoke, all she said was,
"What does that have to do with whether that's Arthur Hawkwing's eye?"
"Just this, girl. With peace, except for what was going on across the ocean, with the people cheering him wherever he went. They really loved him, you see. He was a harsh man, but never with the common folk. Well, with all of that, he decided it was time to build himself a capital. A new city, not connected in any man's mind with any old cause or faction or rivalry. Here, he'd build it, at the very center of the land bordered by the seas and the waste and the blight. Here, where no Aes Sedai would ever come willing, or could use the power if they did.
a capital from which one day the whole world would receive peace and justice. When they heard the proclamation, the common people subscribed enough money to build a monument to him. Most of them looked on him as only a step below the Creator. A short step. It took 5 years to carve and build. A statue of Hawkwing himself, 100 times bigger than the man. They raised it here, and the city was to rise around it.
There was never any city here, Egwene scoffed. There would have to be something left if there was. Something.
Elias nodded, still keeping his watch. Indeed, there was not. Arthur Hawkwing died the very day the statue was finished, and his sons and the rest of his blood fought over who would sit on Hawkwing's throne. The statue stood alone in the midst of these hills. The sons and the nephews and the cousins died, and the last of the Hawkwing's blood vanished from the earth, except maybe for some of those who went over the Arith Ocean. There were those who would have erased even the memory of him if they could. Books were burned just because they mentioned his name. In the end, there was nothing left of him but the stories, and most of them wrong. That's what his glory came to. The fighting didn't stop, of course, just because the Hawkwing and his kin were dead. There was still a throne to be won, and every lord and lady who could muster fighting men wanted it. It was the beginning of the War of the 100 Years. Lasted 123, really, and most of the history of that time is lost in the smoke of burning towns. Many got a part of the land, but none got the whole. And sometime during those years, the statue was pulled down. Maybe they couldn't stand measuring themselves against it any longer.
First you sound as if you despise him, Egwene said, and now you sound as if you admire him.
She shook her head. Elias turned to look at her, a flat, unblinking stare. Get some more tea now, if you want any. I want the fire out before dark. Perrin could make out the eye clearly now, despite the failing light. It was bigger than a man's head, and the shadows falling across it made it seem like a raven's eye, hard and black and without pity. He wished they were sleeping somewhere else.